Welcome to the Future Melbourne Committee meeting here in East Melbourne on Tuesday the 16th of August, and we're starting at 6 p.m. A very dynamic meeting, meeting number 41, with changes still underway, but we're really pleased to see so many of you here with us this evening in East Melbourne. Welcome. The City of Melbourne respectfully acknowledges the traditional owners of the land on which we are gathered, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, and the land on which we govern more broadly, the Bunurong Boonwurrung people, and we pay respects to their elders past and present. We do acknowledge and honour the unbroken spiritual, cultural, and political connection that our traditional custodians have with this unique place and have had for more than 2,000 generations. At the City of Melbourne, we are committed to our reconciliation journey, recognising that at its heart, strengthening relationships between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples has benefits for all Melburnians and Victorians. Can we all please note that we are streaming this meeting live this evening, and we have some cameras here. We're using microphones so we can all hear, but also so that everybody streaming in this evening can hear. And I don't know yet, but there may even be questions that come through via audio or video. And so all of that is happening as we speak. But to let you know that the audio and video recording of the meeting will be made available on our council website by close of business tomorrow, I should say, and the unconfirmed minutes of this meeting will be made available on our website as soon as practicable. Now, a very important thing in this day and age is just to check our phones, if we can check that they're on silent or on or off, I should say, silent or off. That just makes for an undisturbed meeting. That would be fantastic. Thank you. The agenda this evening comprises seven reports from management and one item of general business. And apologies have been received from councillors Doidge and Leloo. I'm noting to all of the members of our committee who are here this evening, councillors and also the public, that where the committee makes a decision on the basis of fewer than six members voting in favour of it, then that decision can be referred by a councillor to council for decision. I know I've said councillor or council about six times in the same sentence, but I hope that makes sense to everybody. We're at item two, which is disclosures of conflicts of interest, and just noting that if a councillor has either a general or a material conflict of interest as defined in the Local Government Act 2020, then please disclose the nature and type of that conflict prior to consideration of the relevant item. Thank you very much. I am calling now on a councillor to move a resolution adopting the minutes of open meeting number 40 that was held on Tuesday, the 2nd of August. It's a little bit awkward here, but I'm looking for somebody to move it. Councillor Hakim, thank you. And Councillor Campbell is seconding that motion. And I'm now putting that motion to the vote. All those in favour of adopting the minutes, that's unanimous. So we declare that motion carried. Thank you, councillors. If I can just ask, are there any matters arising at this stage? No, thank you. The following submissions have been received in accordance with our council governance rules in relation to the agenda this evening. In relation to agenda item 6.2, planning permit application TP-2021-345, Tea House, which is 28 Clarendon Street, Southbank, we've had request to speak from Kare Cronken from Snohetta, which is the architects, and Kare is going to be joining us via Zoom, from Gumji Kang, also from Snohetta. You'll tell me if I'm getting that wrong, and Vaughan Connor from Contour. Thank you. We've got an item of correspondence from Tony Penner from the Southbank Residents Association. In relation to agenda item 6.3 this evening, Carlton Heritage Review and Punt Road Oval, Planning Scheme Amendment C405. We've had items of correspondence from Katie Roberts and also Ewan Ogilvie. In relation to agenda item 6.6, funding for community growth, so we've had an item of correspondence from Dr. Rebecca Lindberg, Director and Chair of the Community Grocer. In relation to agenda item 6.7, opportunity for international engagement, we've had an item of correspondence from Chris Thrum. In relation to agenda item 7.1, notice of motion, Councillor Campbell, injecting room in the City of Melbourne. We've had request to speak from Bon Nguyen, also via Zoom, and Chrissy Maynard, also via Zoom. And then items of correspondence from Loretto Vallant, Bon Nguyen, Alan Mitchell, Gary Danz, Lynn Dixon, Jeffrey Guilfoyle and Shala Kavanagh, Malcolm Bish, Chrissy Maynard, Duncan Johnson from Chairman of Collins Booksellers, R. Morden, Bill Lang, Executive Director of the Small Business Australia, and Judy Ryan, OAM Residence for Victoria Street Drug Solutions. So they are the submissions received this evening. And where I said there's been a request to speak, those presenters will be asked to speak at the time the relevant item is being considered. And advising presenters this evening that we allow 3 minutes for those presentations. We have a podium. Podium, it's not the right word, but you know lectern. What I mean. Lectern, that's the one, thank you. A lectern right here in the middle. So if you could come to the lectern, please tell us your name and give us your presentation. To assist, we have a countdown clock normally. If you're presenting via Zoom, you'll see a countdown clock, but what we do is after 2 minutes you will hear a bell. It's very high tech. To let you know you've got 1 minute left and then another bell at the end of your 3 minutes. If you could please finalise your presentation at that time, it would be appreciated. We've got quite a full agenda, so we'd like to stick to the 3 minutes where we can. Thank you very much. So that's a lot of our setup for the meeting this evening and the agenda. And one of our favourite bits of Future Melbourne Committee meetings is that we have public questions at the start, 15 minutes, and also at the end of our meetings. And now that we've been bringing Future Melbourne Committee meetings out, we're really finding more engagement in our public question time. I'm saying that so that you can prepare yourself. If you haven't previously submitted a question, I will ask once we've gone through the submitted questions if there's anybody else with a question, and we'll just see how we're going for time. But before we do that, and now that we've gone through the administration for this evening, on behalf of councillors and everybody at the City of Melbourne, we just wanted to say a few words about some recent passings. And we wanted to really acknowledge the death of three musical maestros who have each delighted tens of thousands of Melburnians during their illustrious musical careers. I'm going to start by acknowledging Olivia Newton-John, who I had the pleasure of supporting through my involvement with the Olivia Newton-John Cancer Research Institute. But many of us know her in different ways and acknowledge her genuine devotion, in particular to finding a cure and improving the quality of life for so many patients with breast cancer and brain cancers, and the efforts, her leadership and actions are beyond impressive and yielded many positive outcomes for our community. But I know that we're mostly in awe of her talent and her contribution to the music industry. Like so many Melburnians and people around the world, we love her songs, we love her in all of her movies, and we're very motivated with admiration and devotion to Olivia through her life and also her legacy. We'd also like to acknowledge Archie Roach, who performed his last Melbourne show at the Sydney Meyer Music Bowl in a moment of freedom between lockdowns, and it was heralded as a triumph of both music and storytelling. Archie, as well as his incredible musical legacy, which frequently, of course, reflected on his own experiences and upbringing, he also provided inspiring support for other First Nations artists through his foundation, and he, again, will be sorely missed by so many and leaves an amazing legacy. And then Judith Durham, who led the Seekers to become the first Australian pop music group to achieve major chart and sales success in the United Kingdom and the United States. Amazing. and the Seekers sold more than 50 million records worldwide. She was born not far from where we meet this evening, just in Essendon, and was named Victorian of the Year in 2015 for her work in the sector, but also in our community. Amazing charitable work. We do acknowledge that we're so lucky in Melbourne to be the cultural capital of Australia, to have artists like Olivia and Archie and Judith have a connection to Melbourne, and who drew thousands of people to our city with their electrifying performances over decades. They told the story of who we are as Australians, and we are grateful for their lifetime of work and their legacy. So on behalf of everyone here, we acknowledge those legends. Vale. We are now going to move on to our question time. So I've explained that we have 15 minutes. We'll see how we go. For anybody who is asking a question, again, we'll ask you to come to the lectern, tell us your name, and we allow about 90 seconds to ask a question. The questions shouldn't be on an item that's on the agenda this evening, because they would otherwise be submissions. So they're genuinely items of interest to you as members of the community about an issue in our community, but we have received some questions prior, and I'm going to start with James Bartolo, who I believe James is here with us. He did submit a written question, but has asked if he could ask it in person. James, come on down. Thank you. Yes, please come to the podium, lectern, and whatever else we called it. Thank you. Over to you, James, and Councillor Dr. Ball's going to be responding, I believe.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for coming. I've been a resident of East Melbourne for the last 12 years, and I have never seen anything like it in the way of the displaced and homeless people put into the accommodation, mainly in Albert Street in East Melbourne. Since the people have been there since 2020, February, it has been a nightmare. It's a lot better now, but it's still nowhere near what it should be. We have thefts, we have drug dealing, we have drug selling, we have drug using, we have theft in the sense of housing and also vehicles. We have graffiti, we have rubbish. It just doesn't end. The culprit is mainly the Comfort Hotel, 90 Albert Street, East Melbourne. You just have to read the reviews to see what's happening. We back onto the car park of the Comfort Hotel, and between Thursday and Saturday night, it's like living on a Mad Max movie. It's unbelievable. There are drug dealers who come there and they keep their cars idling, and people come from the hotel there, Comfort Hotel. They come out, they buy their drugs, they shoot up and they go back inside. It's not just the people who have been put there by Vic Housing and previously DHHS, but it's also all their associates that come into the area and they shoot up in the car park. The lady who runs the premises has 8 monitors in her office. She chooses to see nothing and does nothing about it. The simple reason being is because if she gets rid of them, she'll lose $800 per week.
Thank you, James. Thank you. For your question. And we did see the written question that you sent through as well. So points well made.
Yes.
Councillor Dr. Ball, who's the chair or the lead of our health and wellbeing and belonging portfolio, is going to provide a response from our offices in terms of current position and reflections. Councillor Dr. Ball.
Thank you, James, for your question tonight. You've raised a number of issues that are the province of the police and of Homes Vic and local government at the City of Melbourne. So our Director of On-Street Compliance, Dean Robertson, I don't know if he's here tonight, he usually is not, will be in touch with you maybe tomorrow?
He already has prior to me coming here.
Great.
Can I just also add that we've had the police there. The police have said, stop ringing us. There's nothing we can do. Okay? I've got my partner who's a witness on that one. I have contacted Building Group of the City of Melbourne. I've contacted Local Laws Traffic, and they all say we can't do anything and you need to take it to VCAT. I've also sent an email, an in-depth email to Shari McPhelan, the Director of Vic Homes. That was on the 5th of June. I'm still waiting for a response.
All right. James, I think we've all really heard that, and that's something that we can certainly look to follow up as well and see what measures can be taken. But thank you so much for raising
for a
very important local issue. James, thank you. Thank you. I'm now calling on Councillor Leppett to read a question and the response that we've received from Nolene Treloar. And I'm just checking that Nolene's not here. Oh, Nolene, did you want to come and ask your question? Or you're okay? Thank you. Well, thank you for submitting that question. I'm handing now to Councillor Leppett, who's the lead on our heritage portfolio. Thank you.
Thanks, Lord Mayor, and thanks, Nolene, for the question. The question was, would Council promote the creation and adoption of a separate planning scheme, including heritage overlay for East Melbourne, only to protect the destruction of its unique heritage, both internal, external and three-dimensional, and not just facadism, historical character and amenity? I'll read out a response which has been provided by Sophie Handley, our Director of City Strategy. Thank you for your question. Council values the unique character and beautiful heritage setting of East Melbourne. Currently, East Melbourne has a large proportion of heritage protected buildings, both on the Victorian Heritage Register and in the local heritage overlay. In considering any proposed development of listed buildings, our new heritage policies recently included in the Melbourne Planning Scheme provide greater guidance around retention of heritage fabric and specifically address facadism. In addition to the existing provisions, we recognise that heritage controls need to be revised over time, and to that end we have committed to commence a heritage review of East Melbourne and Jolimont this financial year. While there is no opportunity to create a new planning scheme for individual suburbs, we do take a neighbourhood approach, and this heritage review project will address the specific character of East Melbourne and Jolimont and identify the key characteristics of the suburb which should be protected. The project will include detailed technical assessments and community engagement to ensure all heritage attributes are captured in the review. We very much look forward to your input to the project over the next couple of years. And I might just add, with a political lens on, that the East Melbourne Group asked all of us in the lead-up to the last election to commission the East Melbourne Heritage Review, and we all agreed to do so at the first opportunity, and that's why it's being commissioned this financial year. So thank you to you and the residents of East Melbourne. Thanks.
Thanks, Councillor Leppett, and thanks again, Nolene. Now, the next two questions lay within the purview of our Deputy Lord Mayor in his role as lead on the city planning portfolio. I know Greg's here, but I didn't know if Greg wanted to jump up. Or happy to be read out, Greg. Okay, good on you. Over to you, Deputy Lord Mayor.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. I'm just checking I've pushed the right button on the microphone here, seeing nods. That's good. Indeed, the first question is from Greg Bissonella, who is the President and Heritage and Planning Convener of the East Melbourne Group. He writes, or asks, the Legislative Council on the 2nd of August tabled in the Victorian Parliament the Environment and Planning Committee's interim report into protections within the Victorian Planning Framework. Inquiry into the protections within the Victorian Planning Framework. The report and its recommendations are supported by the East Melbourne Group and its members. Of particular interest is the Sections 4, Fairness in Planning Decisions, and Section 5, Heritage Protection. Our question is in two parts. Did councillors or the City of Melbourne have any input into the report? Two, does the City of Melbourne and do councillors support the implementation of the recommendations as outlined in the report and detailed below? I will now read out the response to the question as provided by Sophie Handley, who was the Director of City Strategy. Sophie writes, Council did not make a submission to this inquiry and has not yet formed a view on the interim report conclusions and future direction. Management will review the interim report and would be happy to engage with the East Melbourne Group to discuss their views and any potential next steps. And I would just add to Sophie's comment as well to say I'd be very happy to participate in a conversation about that interim report and in particular the matters you've raised. So thanks for that question, Greg. I'll now read out the question we have received from Valerie Stroll. Can you describe the city? Oh, unless Valerie is here and would like to ask the question herself.
I am here.
All right. I'm sure it is excellent. Can you describe the City of Melbourne's ability or scope of influence on planning matters decisions made by Vic government? Using Treasury Square as an example, what powers do you have to influence? One, key planning decisions such as height, design controls and overall development of that site. We acknowledge that the City of Melbourne supported the motion to have design and development overlay Schedule 1 to be applied to the Treasury Square site, but how has City of Melbourne pushed this through to Victorian Government since that decision was made in November 2021? Two, maintain the look and feel of East Melbourne heritage, which is why people choose to live here. I will now read out, Valerie, a response to that question as provided by Sophie Handley, our Director of City Strategy. The City of Melbourne has a long-standing relationship with the Victorian Government where planning matters are referred to Council to input even if there is no statutory requirement for the referral. The City of Melbourne provides the Victorian Government with expert planning advice based on the Melbourne Planning Scheme and can include specific expertise in urban design, heritage and engineering. You are correct. The City of Melbourne did recommend to the Victorian Government that DDO1 should apply to Treasury Square. We have not been successful in this endeavour to date. However, we understand that some elements of DDO1 will be reflected in the development and will continue to advocate for the planning controls to be updated to incorporate the applicable DDO1 controls. East Melbourne benefits from a high level of built form and heritage controls that govern consideration of development applications. The essence of the controls is to maintain the local character of the neighbourhood but allow buildings and places to evolve to meet contemporary housing demands and some growth, in line with its status as an established area in our future planning. In addition to the current provisions, Council has committed to commence a heritage review for East Melbourne, which will ensure that there are appropriate heritage overlays for individual places as well as the precinct. This will incorporate an opportunity for the community to provide their views on protecting the look and feel of the neighbourhood from a heritage perspective. That concludes the answer from Sophie. And look, I would just add to that by making the political point that the City of Melbourne very much recognises the extraordinary and special character of East Melbourne, and we probably invest more resource defending the planning controls in this area in comparison to any other part of the municipality of the City of Melbourne. We did recently release our draft municipal planning strategy. I would really encourage all of you to have a look at that. That document does designate East Melbourne as an established area deserving the strongest possible protections. And I would ask you to review and provide your thoughts about what we have said about the future of this area. As we've heard from Councillor Lippitt, we are also undertaking an East Melbourne heritage review this financial year. Again, that's a priority of this council, and again, encourage you all to participate in that process. Back to you, Lord Mayor.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. We now have a question from Joanne O'Callaghan. I'm not sure if Joanne's here. Are you going to come? That's good, because otherwise people will think I made this question up and put it in under a false name. It's so good. Come on down. Over to you.
All right, thank you. Oh, I've got it written out. So my question is in relation to the Green Line project, Melbourne's version of the New York High Line. It's a visionary idea for our city and I think a brilliant way for us to better embrace the Yarra. And I have contributed to the last consultation, as I will to the current one. Overall, I feel the Green Line, however, is falling well short of its potential. The current project currently presents like a landscaping and boardwalk project, pretty incomparable to New York's High Line in both ambition and design. A more ambitious and engaging headline would incorporate public art, a vital element in the success of New York's High Line, along with community programs and engagement. Green Line also provides an avenue to help us redress the inadequate number of statues of women in Melbourne, some 10 statues among 580. The state government recently put forward some funding toward this particular issue. The Green Line could also significantly enhance, be enhanced with a greater sense of destination at each end of the line, in particular to extend further to east to connect with the MCG, the Tennis Centre and our East Melbourne precinct. I'm interested to understand more details about the predicted $1 billion of economic benefit outside of the construction phase and over what period of time that is expected, and the key drivers for a 2028 completion date, noting that the bold NGV contemporary project will be completed within the same time frame. I would like to ask the Lord Mayor if this is really your vision for the Green Line and whether it's been perhaps compromised by budget or other types of constraints.
Thank you, Joanne. Thank you very much for your question. And we've got Mark Allen, who's the director of that project, providing some feedback and information. And the feedback that we're seeking at the moment, Joanne, is in relation to just stage one of the Green Line project. And the Green Line, as you say, is something that we want to be ambitious and transformational for Melbourne, that really repositions the Yarrabirrung and makes it a centrepiece of culture, economy and livability, incorporating temporary and permanent public art and creative programming. The details of that are still to unfold with the five complete stages of the project. The investment is expected to be approximately $300 million. Would I like that to be more? Absolutely. But there's plenty that can be achieved with that budget. And it's made up of funds that's contributed by council, other levels of government and private sector. And as you said, forecast to generate $1 billion in economic value to the city, creating new employment and attracting additional domestic and international visitors, to name a few. Now, we're working with government partners, landowners and stakeholders to deliver the project to that timeline, which is an ambitious timeline, and you've noted some of the other big projects being delivered during the same timeframe, and there are many others. Completion of Melbourne Metro comes to mind as well. And Mark is encouraging you to be involved with each stage of the rollout of each stage, but what's important is that we are seeking a partner to do the master plan, Joanne, and that's where we'll start to see some of the ambitious elements become more prevalent. We'll start to see spaces for activation and art, as you've suggested, and importantly, the business case will be coming to council for consideration in the next few weeks, so that'll be made available to the public. It's just being finalised at the moment. So all of the elements that you highlighted in your question are still to come to council and the public, and we really encourage you, I certainly do, to stay very much involved as we see that roll out and really support your sense of ambition and transformation. So thanks very much. We are moving on to a written question. I'm conscious of time, but we've had a lot of written questions and I do want to see whether there are other questions in the room. I know there are. A written question from Brian Timms in relation to the City Transport Infrastructure and Operations Portfolio, which I lead. So I'm going to read it out unless Brian's here and wants to say it. And it's a question saying that parking in some East Melbourne streets is under great pressure due to multiple factors. Our medical facilities, tradies, playgrounds, child minding, MCG sports, etc. Availability of parking for residents is regularly adversely impacted. Can we please have a greater focus on compliance with parking sign rules, including a greater allocation of parking inspectors and use of technology. And Crystal Maynard, who's our Director of Parking Services, has said, as in all inner city areas, on-street parking in East Melbourne is indeed under strain due to the high volume of resident parking, visitors to the hospital, sporting precincts and tradespeople. The parking compliance team is aware of this and makes East Melbourne a high focus for its compliance operations, parking officers in East Melbourne 7 days a week with a bespoke patrol strategy for the area, and we roster additional officers to assist during AFL matches. Officers use a mix of technology and on-foot patrols to detect parking offences and issue fines to illegal parkers to encourage them to modify their parking behaviour in the future. And the Director of Parking Services recently met with the East Melbourne group, I believe Crystal came, and to discuss parking concerns and to understand that enforcement approach. But I wonder, Greg, whether there were some other ideas put to our team at that time, because I know just in discussions tonight there have been some quite creative thoughts on how we could possibly also address the issues, particularly at times of football. And that might be a follow-up action from this in terms of using the East Melbourne group, if we can, working with, I should say, to look at some of those ideas. And so we can wait for any further questions, but that would be a good thing we could do together. I'll take that as a follow-up item. There's another written question received from Therese Donato in relation to the same portfolio, and it says, is there a possibility of providing or installing public amenities in the grounds surrounding the MCG to prevent people attending major events from urinating in surrounding neighbouring streets once they leave the ground? Another issue that's been raised tonight before the meeting started. This appears to be very common and a problem post AFL and cricket matches. I've previously spoken with the City of Yarra, who advised me that this is a City of Melbourne issue, which it is. It's in our municipality, working with the manager of the park. But David Callow, who's our Director of Parks and Greening, says thanks to Therese for the question. Yarra Park is ultimately managed by the Melbourne Cricket Ground Trust, Cricket Club Trust, and Council will forward the concern to them. But I do think, again, that's something, it's in my portfolio, something I can follow up in a more proactive way, just to see what other solutions we could actually put to the Melbourne Cricket Club Trust for ways in which we could manage that better. Another question received prior from Christopher Lee. Chris, I saw you earlier. Yes, would you like to come and ask your question? Thank you so much.
Thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity. It's a great initiative. My question simply relates to Wellington Parade, which I find a cold, hard area. You may or may not be aware of the development that's going on at 122, 130 Victoria Wellington Parade, where the post office is. That's not the area I'm actually talking about. I'm talking about over Wellington Parade itself. Presumably when the work goes on, there will be some form of gantry. I could be wrong. But I was thinking, why not extend that gantry over Wellington Parade at a level of about level three or above, right across, even over the railway line, so that you had an extensive outdoor area there that you could trial as an area, as a terrace for people to use. The view you'd get would be quite extraordinary in towards Melbourne. And it actually would act as a gateway. When you drove through, all of a sudden you'd see the Melbourne Vista there. It's just a thought. I don't know where this goes, so I thought that I'd just raise it at this sort of meeting. Thanks for your time.
Is it a new rooftop bar sort of thing almost?
Shane Warne flight deck.
Shane Warne flight deck. I'm loving it. Should we take that question on notice, Evan? Yeah. We're certainly thinking creatively on gantries, isn't it? Suggest to the developer. Christopher, thank you for that question. Yeah. Or the start. Very good. Thank you. Thank you for that. I'm now going to cast around. We do have 15 minutes at the end of the meeting, but for some people that that's too late into the evening. So I'm just looking around to see if there is anybody here who would like to approach me. Come on up to ask a question this evening.
I hope this is all right. It's actually an acknowledgement. You did acknowledgement of the passing of three fabulous Melburnians, but there's a fourth that passed away on Friday night, and that was Lillian Frank. And Lillian was an extraordinary Melburnian in many ways that people mightn't have known, because when she was certainly flamboyant and interesting, but she was multifaceted, and she was a quintessential part of the heart and soul of Melbourne. Her daughter Jackie wrote in the media that she was, you know, passing of the heart and soul of her family, and indeed she was, but she was also the heart and soul of many, many other people and organisations and charities, and indeed of Melbourne. And I can personally vouch for that. She's been in my life for many, many decades. She was a yes person and an example to us all. She used her influence and her personality and her contacts from hairdressing and social activities to raise extraordinary funds for the Royal Children's Hospital and also for Odyssey House. She received an MBE from the British Empire, I think in about 1971. I haven't prepared this, so it might not be correct. Then in about 1991, I think it was, that she received an AM here for her community services. I can personally vouch that there wasn't anything of benefit to Melbourne or to charity that you could ask her to do or to be involved in that she would say no to. She was a yes person and that way an example to us all, and she worked tirelessly and with good humour on every matter I've ever seen her do. She was genuine and kind, and I think we can all learn a lot from that. She's an inspiration, and I just wanted to acknowledge her along with the other three.
Entirely appropriate. Thank you, Bea.
Thank you.
And Justin just said that she did the Queen's hair when the Queen was here. So
she did the Queen's hair. I can tell you
stories
about her, whatever. But she was fun, but she was serious. She's done anything that I've ever asked her to be involved with, and she was a personal friend, and I miss her. But she will live on. Her legacy includes so much for Melbourne. People say she was the first influencer in Melbourne because she was involved in fashion, and she used her media and flamboyance and an open personality to do whatever she could do to publicise or help any issue or any matter she thought that was important. She certainly added colour and vibrancy to the City of Melbourne, and I know that's something our Lord Mayor appreciates. But an extraordinary person, and will be much less, but her legacy will live on.
Bea, thank you. Very appropriate and appreciated. Thank you very much. Thank you. Is there anybody else that wanted? Yeah, Ian, come on up. And then...
Thank you for allowing me the time. I have already spoken to a number of councillors before this, but I thought it'd be worthwhile documenting my question. Given the 100-plus objections to the proposed Magnolia Court Hotel in the middle of the residential area and the East Melbourne groups and neighbours' representations, how did you arrive at the decision to still approve the application, which only benefits a Singaporean developer? Do you really believe this serves the East Melbourne community to have us now fighting your decision at VCAT?
Are we taking that on notice, or I'm looking at the Deputy Lord Mayor or an officer? I think you were there that night we made the decision.
We'll take the question on notice and respond in detail. It's in a VCAT process, as I understand. So we'll just confirm the application details, and we're happy to provide a response back to any residents who want to talk about the detail of that process and the council's position on the question. The report is publicly available.
I think it would be very useful for us to know the council's strength of conviction and indeed what we will be fighting at VCAT. In other words, you know, we'd like to know whether council is going to have QCs etc., presenting the case, which has occurred in the past.
Okay, I think that's deserving of a meeting. Okay. So why don't we set that up so that we can share the appropriate information? I think it's set down for the end of October.
Yes.
So we've got time to do that. So I'm looking at Evan and Dylan.
Yeah. And look, I'm happy, as along with any other councillor who wishes to participate, to be part of that conversation, as we have been in the past, ahead of matters going to VCAT.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've got one more question here and then we'll move on to the agenda. Welcome.
Thank you. Tracy McDonald, I'm a resident of East Melbourne and I live in Powlett Street. I echo what Ian's just said about Magnolia Court, and I've got a number of people's ears tonight and I'll keep doing it. And I won't apologise for that. But my question is actually about lighting in the Fitzroy Gardens. And it's a real safety concern for me. I wear high heels, I walk to the city, I love walking to the city, I'm walking over there for dinner tonight, and I feel that, and I've raised this before, I've spoken to Ray about it, and she came back to me saying, oh, a lighting upgrade's already been done, it was done last year. Well, that whole floral walk, which is the main thoroughfare from East Melbourne, where a number of older people live and also a number of single female professionals. Now, we know about atrocities that have been committed in other major parklands in Victoria and horrible crimes, but that is not well lit. It is not a safe environment. I have daughters in their 20s. They don't feel safe walking through the park at night. Now, some of the paths are reasonably well lit, but the major thoroughfare is very poorly lit, and I've been told that it's been upgraded and it's all good. It's not not good enough.
Noted. I'll have a walk there myself one night.
But yeah, I think, and I did say I'd meet the person there, even at 5:30 in winter.
Mm.
But there's a lot of frontline health workers who walk through the park from the various hospitals after their shifts to cars, to parking, yep, etc. And it's good. Just not safe. It's beautiful parkland, but it's not safe.
Point made. Thank you, Tracy. And Justin's got it on his list, our CEO. So let's follow up. And not to say that Ray wasn't doing her best as well in terms of following up. So. Yeah, got it. Thank you. Good. Well, thank you very much for participating so fully in our question time this evening. As we can see, a range of issues covered, and we really do appreciate you raising them, some of them ongoing conversations and some of them new. So it's been really worthwhile from our perspective. Thank you very much. We are now going to move on to reports from management, and we have a number of those this evening. And agenda item 6.1 is neighbourhood key issues and City of Melbourne projects for East Melbourne. And I'm calling on Rushda Halith, who is the director of our community development group, to make a presentation this evening. I hope everybody had a chance to have a look at that report in relation to East Melbourne. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Good evening, councillors. It's great to be here to talk to you about City of Melbourne's work in and connection to the East Melbourne community. As you know, we might move to the first slide. Thanks, Jordan. As you know, we started a neighbourhood approach last year, a new way of working for City of Melbourne, looking to achieve three outcomes. Firstly, recognising that the different neighbourhoods that make up our municipality are diverse and unique with their own individual strengths, opportunities and needs, and looking at how we can bring those insights into the organisation to guide our work. Secondly, the priority was to really look at how can we work in partnership with community and different parts of our communities to realise some of those shared priorities. And thirdly, it's about increasing our reach into community across our municipality, whether that's workers, visitors, residents, businesses, students, the very diverse makeup we do have in our municipality. We want to increase that reach and hear from people and enable them to engage better to help shape our city. This is just the first year and an ongoing way of working for City of Melbourne, and one very small part of this approach is having these Future Melbourne committee meetings in community. Next slide, please. This is a quick snapshot of the East Melbourne community, and we now have the refreshed ABS data, which provides some interesting insights about the makeup of the community. So East Melbourne has 3% of the overall municipality's residential population and 4% of the businesses in the municipality. The East Melbourne has the highest median age for the municipality at 42. Some interesting contrasts to the broader municipality. 18% of people speak a language other than English at home in East Melbourne, compared to 50%+ in the broader municipality. And more people in the broader municipality live in a flat or apartment or live in a rented household as well. So again, speaking to that point of unique neighbourhood characteristics that we look at. Next slide, please. We have a number of services and facilities and spaces in East Melbourne, which includes the Powlett Reserve Children's Centre and the East Melbourne Library. There's a real focus on more inclusive arts and library programming, with an emphasis on digital literacy in this financial year. A number of parks and green spaces in East Melbourne, including Fitzroy Gardens and Treasury Gardens, which are sort of destination capital city open spaces that were talked about today. And we've invested approximately $1.7 million as part of our 2022-23 budget in East Melbourne, covering a range of different things, including renewal works, road safety, green space infrastructure, cycle infrastructure, and so on. Next slide, please. So the neighbourhood planning, which is a core part of our neighbourhood model, we've started really doing some deep dives across the municipality to understand where people are at and what they're seeing as priorities, asking questions around what do you love about your neighbourhood, what's missing, what are your priorities, how connected do you feel, do you want to participate, what does that look like for you, and so on. So in East Melbourne, we've heard from around 6,000 people across the municipality. During our first phase of engagement in East Melbourne, we heard from 300 people. 71% of those we heard from hadn't engaged with City of Melbourne in any capacity before, so we're really tapping into people more broadly in the community as well, which is very exciting. We have Rhea Chin, who is the neighbourhood partner for East Melbourne, and she's been working closely with different parts of the community and being really supported by the East Melbourne a residence group as well as part of this work, which has been fantastic. Where we've analysed what we're hearing across the municipality, and we're currently in the second stage consultation, which is live at the moment, really sharing back what we've heard, what priorities the community has identified, to really test if we've captured them, is anything missing. A lot of the priorities we heard, which I'll touch on in a second, were coming through as questions today. So I think there's real alignment in terms of community sentiment with what we're hearing today as well. What we want to get to is in October or November of this year, each of our neighbourhoods, including East Melbourne, will have their own portal, which is a one-stop shop for community. We heard through this planning process, we don't really want a static four-year neighbourhood plan. We want something that's more dynamic. We want something that's iterative. We want to be able to see action. So the neighbourhood portal will capture all of the priorities the community has identified with regular updates, so you can see how we're tracking, working together on those priorities. It will have community stories showcasing what community is doing in response to those priorities, lots of resources and information about the neighbourhoods. And that's just the first version of the portals, and we hope to evolve them as time goes by as well. Next slide, please. So this is some baseline data that we've been capturing across the municipality and comparing East Melbourne again to broader City of Melbourne. An interesting contrast is people in East Melbourne actually feel more connected to their local community compared to the broader city, with 66% compared to the 54% in the City of Melbourne. But it's also interesting to then see while people feel connected, they feel less informed about what's happening in their local community and even less empowered to participate at 56% and 50%. But that's more in line with the numbers we're seeing across the city. So it'll be interesting to see how these numbers shift over time as well. Next slide, please. We've heard a lot from the community as part of the neighbourhood consultation, and this is just a snapshot, very brief snapshot. But some of the things that particularly came through today, we know that heritage is a key priority for this community, and we have the heritage review coming up for East Melbourne and Jolimont. We also heard that road safety is a particular concern, and there's a win that we can talk to with the 40 kilometre zones in local roads in East Melbourne coming. The implementation date is the 12th of September for that to happen. That's been a really key priority for the community. It's going to be rolled out from the 12th to about the 16th, and I think there's been messaging going out to key stakeholders today about it. It's been a key priority for the community, and it's great to have delivered on that, and many thanks to our infrastructure team for their work on that. We also have a pedestrian safety review currently underway, and there'll be recommendations from that review which will address some of the other road safety concerns. There's also been concerns raised today and during the consultations around antisocial behaviour and theft in the community. We're hearing that. We're also working closely with the neighbourhood policing initiative that the Victoria Police is undertaking in partnership with the City Safety and Amenity branch at City of Melbourne. The neighbourhood partners are closely working with the neighbourhood policing initiative to make sure they understand these specific concerns, and hopefully we can deliver some targeted outcomes through that work as well. We've also heard very clearly that community spaces and parking accessibility is a key issue for this community, and it's important to the community. We've heard this, and we're working on it. And this is a good part about having these portals and having these priorities captured, is so that you can see progress as we update you periodically on some of this. So this is just a bit of a flavour about some of the priorities coming through in East Melbourne. Next slide, please. So this last slide is just QR code, the consultation to test back with you whether we've captured what the community has told us is right, and appreciate the feedback, if encouraging everyone to jump in and contribute. Thank you, Lord Mayor.
Thank you, Rushta. And these reports are being done for every one of our neighbourhoods, and it is about better understanding who we're representing in the neighbourhoods, but also represents a new operational approach to how we resource and service our neighbourhoods. So your participation is really appreciated to ensure that we're getting that right. Thank you, Rushta. I'm now calling on I guess, were there any other questions? Sorry, I should ask from councillors. No, then I'm calling on a councillor to move the motion. Councillor Dr. Ball, thank you. And a councillor to second the motion. Councillor Hakim, thank you. Over to you, Councillor Dr. Ball.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. And thank you, Rushta, for presenting this paper to us. If you found that interesting, I do commend the report to you. It's a 9-page summary describing the suburb and specifically council's work here, because I think you'll find it very interesting. And if that interests you, then you are going to love the online portal that is coming in October. So if you look at Participate Melbourne, if you Google Participate Melbourne, you'll find it. The East Melbourne specific page is not ready until October, but that is going to be the interface between council and all of our constituents. And we look forward to that. And as Rushta has just very ably presented, the point of that is to enact a community development model where the community gets to define the questions that we tackle as council as much as inform the answers to those questions. So grab that opportunity with both hands. It's quite new, and I hope you'll find it a very useful and gratifying way to interact with council. We are particularly delighted. Another expression of that outreach and that community-based approach is us being here tonight. Instead of meeting at Town Hall, as of course is normal, this is a new phase of practice, which is the first time in living memory, not tonight, but in this round, of meeting in the suburbs of our municipality, and we're very delighted to be here in gorgeous East Melbourne, the envy of everyone who comes here. It happens to be my birthplace, Ioneer Hospital, which is no longer has a maternity wing. So I'm personally very delighted to be back here in this beautiful, treasured, lush, green, verdant and heritage-rich part of our municipality, with treasured municipal assets like your gorgeous library and those highlights of things that are yet to come in the imminent future for bring that council is bringing here to East Melbourne. We've heard already several of these things, like the outdoor exercise equipment for pallet reserve that you have asked for, and we will be responding by implementing the reduced speed limits for all local roads in East Melbourne coming in September. So be alert to that so you don't get a ticket. And of course, the money we're spending on the key infrastructure that you need in East Melbourne, upgrading and maintaining and introducing, including $130,000 on cycle infrastructure and $170,000 on green open space infrastructure and cultural projects for East Melbourne in particular. We've also heard about the East Melbourne and Jolimont Heritage Review in response to your concerns about protecting your heritage, and we have heard those concerns. It will be implemented, as we've heard, in this financial year, or commenced rather. The review will be commenced in this financial year. And you may not have clocked what, I'll just stands repeating what Rushta said about your neighbourhood partner, who is Ray Chin. Is she here tonight? Hello, Ray. So every suburb or neighbourhood of the municipality now has a key contact person on the staff at the City of Melbourne. So Ray is your contact person. You'll find her contact details on Participate Melbourne or get in touch with her. She's here tonight in order to meet with you. So that's enough. Thank you very much, Rushta, because you ably presented it. Nothing more for me to add. I'm delighted to move this motion and encourage you all to look at the report.
Thank you, Councillor Dr. Ball. Very poetic as well. Thank you. Councillor Hakim, to you as seconder. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and thank you, Councillor Dr. Ball. I don't know how to follow on for that. What a beautiful description of East Melbourne. It is a special place, and in fact, or maybe an extra fact I can add, it's linked to Docklands with one tram, so you can go door-to-door from Docklands to East Melbourne, which is terrific. So I look forward to that partnership. I have spent a bit of time in East Melbourne, and you shared some stories today that are reflective, and earlier today, reflective of this community. And I heard a story, if I may share it, which is that there's a Sunday lunch that's been going on for 40 years. And, you know, that is reflective of a neighbourhood that wants to be connected as a community, as we've heard, and I commend you on that. I mean, where else can you be in the middle of the hustle and bustle, yet have the serenity of the parks and green spaces like you do right here in East Melbourne? I urge you to get involved in the neighbourhood model, the next step of consultation, as you heard from Rushta, closes on the 4th of September, but it is an iterative model. So get to know your neighbourhood partner, build on that iterative process as part of what we're doing. It's a dynamic, evolving plan, your plan for your neighbourhood. So please do get involved. I commend and support this motion to councillors.
Thank you very much, Councillor Hakim. Are there any other councillors who would like to speak to this motion? Then I'm putting the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous, so we declare that motion carried. That was our first item on our reports from management this evening. Thank you very much. I'm now going to call on our Deputy Lord Mayor, Nicholas Rees, who's going to assume the role of chair of this part of the meeting in relation to our city planning portfolio. Over to you, Deputy Lord Mayor.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. There are indeed two reports from management for consideration under the planning portfolio this evening. The first of those is Agenda Item 6.2, Planning Permit Application TP-2021-345 for the Tea House, which is located at 28 Clarendon Street, South Bank. Do any councillors need to declare a conflict in regards to this item? No, and I think that councillors do not need a presentation either. So in that case, I will call on Kare Cronkin from Snowheta Architects, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. And I believe Kare is joining us via video this evening. I'm just looking to our...
I am. Can you hear me, Melbourne?
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear.
Thank you very much. So if I can then start, and I can see the slide, so that's perfect. Good evening, Melbourne. Next slide, please. My name is Cora Crokiner, and I am an architect and a partner and managing director at Snøhetta, a Norwegian multidisciplinary design practice named after a mountain in Norway, that beautiful mountain. Next, please. So Snøhetta has a handful of studios across the world, which includes our Australasian studios in Melbourne and Adelaide. Next, please. We have a number of significant international and local heritage connected projects, such as our work on Arts Centre Melbourne's theatre building upgrade in association with Melbourne-based NH Architecture, as well as our extension to Mario Botta's design in San Francisco's Museum of Modern Art in the bottom right. Our projects have high sustainability ambitions in regards to environmental, social and financial performance. And as an example is the Brattekaia project, and I apologize for the difficult Norwegian names, which is an office building that produces more energy than what it consumes in its lifespan, as well as our Norwegian National Opera and Ballet, which is an example of social sustainability where the roof of the building is turned into a public space. Next one, please. So when we were approached by Costa Fox about this project, we decided internationally and locally that this is an important project for us to be a part of. Important due to the potential of this gateway threshold site, currently very much an island site, but also, and more importantly, or just as important at least, the beauty and fantastic story, history of the tea house. Next, please. And our design that we are looking forward to show to you is all about the tea house. We learned early through the design process about the engineering masterpiece that the tea house was back in the days when it was built 6 story tall, by far the tallest building built on silty soil at that time. Next one, please. And we were particularly taken by the ancillary buildings that the tea house historically had and the spaces and connections them in between, the almost Melbourne-like laneways. Next, please. So our proposal explores new companion buildings with the tea house in the centre, not the largest, and not the smallest of the buildings. So we are trying to restore the past prominence, you might say, of the tea house, and obviously with the attempt of turning it no longer into an island site. And these buildings together, they form a transition between South Melbourne, the commercial buildings in South Melbourne, and down towards the Yarra River. So from Snøhetta's point of view, all I can say is that we are extremely proud of this design, which already has become an internal reference project for us, an exemplar design for us in Snøhetta in regards to heritage interpretation and urban design. And that concludes my 3 minutes. And I think I'm going to hand over now to our local Melbourne-based architect, Gumji Kang, who will talk through the next few slides.
Thank you very much, Kare, for addressing us tonight. And I now call on Gumji Kang, who's also from Snøhetta, to speak for no more than 3 minutes, please.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor. And thanks, Cora, for introducing. So in the next slide, building on the architectural design principles, we have also worked on a series of urban design principles with our local landscape architect partner, Aspect. The focus of the urban design principle was really to repair the site's connectivity and also to provide a new and engaging public space to the north of the site, really strengthening the connectivity to the Yarra Promenade. So in the next slide, we have an illustrated plan that shows the extent of the new public open space, the tea garden, and also showing the connection to Yarra Promenade. So thinking about all of these design principles that Cora and I just talked about, in the next slides, we would just like to walk you all through to the project. So we get off the tram at the Melbourne Convention and Exhibition Centre stop, and in the next slide, as you approach the site, you start to see the new public space and all the rooftop spaces on top of the cascading built forms. In the next slide, you arrive at the public open space with a new hospitality space beyond. In the next slide, we move through to the tea house building and we arrive at the new laneway between the new built form and the tea house building. In the next slide, we also, as a design gesture, this is a nod back to the characteristic laneway form of the Melbourne city. So in the next slide, we arrive at the main arrival space for the hotel building. And we would just also like to highlight that all of these spaces and the views really, you know, highlight the view back to the tea house as well. So now we take the stairs up to see the rooftop space, again, looking back at the tea house building. So in the next slide, we'll be looking at the view from the Normanby Road, and the new built form really starts to bring the tea house back to the urban scale of South Bank and to once again celebrate the tea house as an iconic Melbourne landmark. So on that note, actually, we might end with a short animation. Thank you.
A little glitchy, I think.
Billy, we're having some
technical setting the mood.
Yeah. I mean, I could narrate it for you guys, but.
All right, if we could. I have a question, if that's okay. Just check with the team.
What's going on?
Here we go. Thank you very much for that. So I actually have some questions, but we might do them at the end so that then you can choose between the presenters this evening who wishes to respond to them. So thank you very much for that presentation. And I'll now call on Vaughan Connor from Contour. I'll speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome back to FMC, Vaughan.
Thank you, Councillor Rees, Deputy Lord Mayor, Lord Mayor and fellow councillors. I'm a director of Contour and we represent the Costa Fox Group. And thank you to Kyrie and Gumji for their presentation. This is a good project for Melbourne. It has the potential to be a transformational project and one that will rejuvenate this part of the city. At 3,000 square metres, there cannot be any doubt that the site represents a strategic opportunity. This opportunity includes, firstly, the ability to embrace and engage with the site's history. Secondly, the ability to deliver a clever and sensitively managed juxtaposition of heritage and contemporary architecture, and by doing so to add to the complexity of layers of development which characterise our city. Thirdly, to adapt and reuse the site and the existing building in a long-term sustainable way for a combination of hotel, hospitality and commercial uses. And lastly, to repair and contribute to the public realm experience in the area. To realise this opportunity and deliver a truly international design standard, the global design studio Snoetta were engaged, and it was their track record with the important interplay of built form and public realm that was a good fit. Of course, there have been challenges throughout the process, and these have included civil infrastructure, flood mitigation and acoustic considerations associated with the interface to MCEC. But all of these challenges are manageable, and there's a suite of conditions dealing with these issues set out in the officer's recommendation. As far as heritage considerations, the prescribed separate process through Heritage Victoria will be followed and a permit will be sought. To this end, we acknowledge Heritage Victoria's refusal decision in relation to an earlier proposal for the site. However, our strong submission is that the current proposal is far more sophisticated in terms of the overall design proposition, and this is confirmed by heritage expert advice that we've sought. We also note that the project will carry circa $18 million worth of conservation works to the Tea House building, and the economic and reasonable use considerations will be paramount in the heritage approval process. Now, in response to this opportunity and these inherent challenges, it is our submission that Snoetta have struck the right design balance, and what is before council is design excellence. Firstly, in relation to the public realm, the submitted plans articulate the repair of the Clarendon Street and Normanby Road streetscapes, adjusted to Melbourne's laneways, and a generously publicly accessible open space on the north side of the tea house. It is also noted that the ability to deliver this public space has been the subject of consultation with MCEC regarding the need to relocate some services, and we've engaged with council officers regarding this part of the proposal. And ultimately, that's going to be a tripartite arrangement with us, council and MCEC. And it's hoped that this public space will be the catalyst for further investment in the public realm extending north to the river. Within the public realm, there's assembly of buildings that retain the significance of the tea house, and they achieve a graduation in height from Whiteman Street down to the river. The assembly of buildings are also varied in their height, their articulation, program and the architectural composition. And the outcome is, again, an international design standard. To this end, testament to the design is the agreement which has been reached with an international hotel operator. And this tenant underpins the whole of the project and the investment. In summary, it is hoped, or in summary, firstly, I want to thank council officers for their efforts. And tonight's presentation, hopefully it properly demonstrates the overall design merit, and I commend it to the council. Thank you.
All right, thanks very much for that, Vaughan. There may be questions from councillors. I'm happy to lead off. Look, I agree that the design of the towers looks terrific in the architectural drawings, in the renders. I guess I just want to test you, and I don't know if this is for you, Vaughan, or for Gumji, but in terms of the quality of the facade, you've got the terracotta coloured aluminium, the coloured concrete. How can we as councillors be confident that the finished building is going to look as good as the architectural drawings, and it's not going to, let's say, fade over time, but fade very quickly, or be value managed out at some stage in this process?
Well, firstly, I'd say it was a pretty hot issue during the assessment of the application, and we had council urban design officers adamant that they wanted to see samples of the materials, you know, prior to, you know, providing their support for the project. And we have samples which we can show you at a point in time or tonight if you really were interested, in order to achieve an outcome which you see on the screen. There's also a series of conditions which have been imposed, including a facade strategy, including the ongoing retention of Snoetta into, you know, with the documentation of the delivery of the project. And we're confident that what you see will be delivered.
All right, thanks. Second question, again, the architecture drawings feature and the design drawings feature some very generous greenery. and green infrastructure. Again, we see a lot of architectural greenery on buildings, and often it doesn't look like that in the finished product. How can we be confident that the green infrastructure in this project will look like it does on the brochure?
As Gumji mentioned, aspect of the landscape or the public realm sort of partners in the overall design conversation and the work which has been done, and they've got, you know, tremendous experience in the delivery of that element within the overall architectural composition. But I would say it's, compared to some buildings you'll see, I think it's a modest amount of sort of vertical green, you know, on the buildings, and clearly the rooftops provide a different opportunity, but there's opportunities there with planter beds and irrigation and so forth. So there'll be a methodology which has to be, you know, adopted, and you know, that will be delivered as, again, as per the plans.
All right, and look, final one from me. Obviously, this is, you know, one of Melbourne's most significant heritage buildings. This matter is going to go before Heritage Victoria. That's a separate process to the planning process we're assessing tonight. This has been to Heritage Victoria twice before, being knocked back twice before, I believe. Why have you not gone to Heritage Victoria first to get something squared away with them before coming to us with the planning application? Obviously, by going to Heritage Victoria second, you run the risk that Heritage Victoria will knock back that application, and then you'll have to come back to us with an amended design or a new building altogether and go through a planning process again. So just wanting to know why you've done it in the way you have.
Well, firstly, I'd say, Councillor, it's not the first time that a matter's been before you which, you know, requires that separate process to be followed. Secondly, we have engaged with Heritage Victoria. We engaged with him early, broadly, about the concept. Heritage Victoria took the step of reaching out to the OVGA with specific heritage-related terms of reference. There was a heritage expert put on the OVG panel, and the outcome of two separate OVGA processes or panel hearings was general support for the proposal, which is also referenced in the officer's report. We had a choice whether we run parallel processes or separate processes. We thought it was important to lock in the overall urban design proposition, and in parallel with that, do the work and the detailed work which is necessary to understand the extent of conservation works, and that has added up to the $18 million which I've spoken, which I mentioned. Not only it was the detail associated with that, but it's also the extra layers of drawings and so forth which needed to be prepared to make up the heritage application. So, yes, there's another process. We're confident we'll back ourselves through that process. But if changes have to be made and we have to come back here, there's a process to facilitate that, as we're aware of.
All right. Thanks, Vaughan. Any other questions from councillors on this application?
I just had a quick one. Vaughan, that intersection is really awkward for lots of reasons, and managing traffic on the other side, and let alone this side. I think it's great that the corner will be activated, because it's such a quiet part of the city at the moment. Could you just give us some quick indication about how we're going to manage traffic with the hotel residents, etc., and how that's going to be, how you're planning for that?
Yes. So the vehicle access strategy comes off the western end of the Normanby Road frontage, which is the most sensible part. You wouldn't take access from Clarendon Street or anywhere near the corner. So we've pushed it as far west as we can. There's been a traffic engineering report which has looked at the access strategy. It's been critiqued by council's traffic engineers and been found to be acceptable. But I couldn't agree more. That intersection is the most over-engineered intersection in Melbourne, and tightening up of that and improving the public realm around it, you know, a good medium to long-term project. But we hope that the repair of the public realm that I've referred to and the open space on the north side of the building can be the catalyst for further investment in this precinct and improving that public realm, connections to the river, connections back towards, you know, Fisherman's Bend and the Montague precinct, and South Melbourne as well, heading south. So there's a big opportunity there, and hopefully this is the start of it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Vaughan, for your presentation this evening. I will now propose to move a motion, which I'd request please be put on the screen. Yep, that is the one. I'm going to move that motion. I'm looking for a councillor to second it. Thank you, Councillor Lippitt. And I'll now speak to this matter. So the Robur Tea House is indeed one of the most architecturally or engineering and heritage significant buildings in Melbourne. It was built, as we heard, south bank of the Yarra there in Coode Island silt. There was very deep piles that were driven in order to be able to make a building of that height be built back in the day. Also had a steel frame, which I think was the first in Australia to be used. So from an engineering and heritage perspective, it's a really, really important building. It's quite a remarkable old building. It was the tallest building outside the city centre for a long time, and it stands as today as a testament to South Bank's industrial heritage. Firstly, it operated as a warehouse and a printing factory. Later, it became a warehouse for the Robur Tea Company, where it got its name. It's been used recently as an office building and an innovation centre. If you go there, there's actually a plaque saying that Senator John Button opened it as an innovation centre back in the 80s. I'm sure there's some people here tonight who remember Senator John Button. And indeed, it's a really important part of the history of Melbourne in so many respects. The application we're considering this evening is for a substantial development of the tea house site. There's two new buildings on the north and south ends of the site. It's got a residential hotel, offices and retail premises. As we've already flagged, any application to develop the site must respect the building's heritage. And what we're considering tonight is the planning application and just the planning application. Heritage Victoria will make a separate determination on the application from a heritage perspective, which council will be invited to comment on. So that means that tonight the job for councillors is to consider whether the application complies with the relevant planning policy controls for this site in South Bank. So looking at this from a planning perspective, I am pleased to say that with the conditions that are recommended in the delegate's report, the building complies with the relevant planning controls and does have a number of very positive features to it. I do believe that it complies with the Design Development Overlay and Design Development Overlay 6, DDO1, DDO60, which are the planning controls that ensure new buildings in the CBD and surrounds are exceptionally well designed and make a positive contribution to their surrounding area. I think the renders that we saw this evening, you know, show a building that is quite striking and will be a real addition to the built form and the skyline down in South Bank. I also think that too often when it comes to buildings in a heritage context, we see architects try to take the easy way out and build a sort of featureless glass cube that they just sort of stick on top of the host building, and that's certainly not the case here. I think there's been a really thoughtful design effort done here to create a building which references the host building in terms of its colour scheme and some of the design motifs, and is very sympathetic to it. So I really do commend the quality of the design work in a heritage setting. As I flagged in the question posed earlier, I think it is really, really important that that facade strategy is implemented, and I'm very pleased that the officer's report does really put in what I call belt and braces in terms of ensuring that that facade is maintained to the quality which is in the submission. I know there has been an actual physical inspection of the materials, of the aluminium, of the concrete, of the different materials that are going to go into this building, and I guess I want to make it really clearly known that we don't we won't be tolerating any value management here that sees the quality of those materials decline and therefore the building fade all too quickly before us. I also think there's lots of varied shapes and forms used in the buildings, which again is really encouraging to see and does work well and complement the Robur Tea House. And yeah, again, I compliment the degree of effort that has gone into that. I also want to just single out the new public open space that is proposed to the north and south of the tea house. So I think it's good to see the activation of the Normanby Road side of the development. And again, there's a condition in the officer's report which goes further in that respect. I think activating that side of the building is really important. And I think really excitingly, that creation of a new forecourt on the south side that links through to the convention centre will create a really exciting and inviting new publicly accessible space in South Bank, which I think will be a magnet for people into South Bank and a place where you'd want to go and dwell, particularly given the Robur Tea House and the fabric, you know, old heritage fabric there. It's a place where people will want to go and hang out.
Can I ask a question about this?
I'm sorry, you can't, not at this stage. Sure, let me return to that. So as the officer's report mentions, as the Lord Mayor has mentioned, that intersection with Normanby Road and Clarendon Street does have challenges to it. And so as part of this development, it would be good to see the City of Melbourne to work on ways to make that a more inviting intersection, particularly for pedestrians and for cyclists. Finally, as the officer's report does make clear, this building does comply with the built form controls, including height limits in this part of the city. And so in the sense that it is complies with existing policy, it is supported by the officers. And that is the recommendation to councillors. Now, I finish by saying that this application still has a long way to go. It still has to go before Heritage Victoria, and there's an entire process that would be gone through there, which takes into account a whole range of factors that go beyond the built form controls that apply to the planning application that is before us this evening. So on that note, and noticing there's still a long way to go, happy to commend the motion for us this evening. Councillor Leppett.
Thank you, Chair, I agree. The difficulty here, as you've set out, is that this is only the planning matter and we're not considering the heritage matter. So I know this is already known and clear to the applicant, but obviously agreeing on the planning side doesn't actually in any way prejudice the heritage process or in fact the City of Melbourne's submission on the heritage process, which has not been begun to be assessed given that there's no matter before Heritage Victoria just yet. So all the issues around whether or not the tea house itself has been given adequate distance from the new built form, whether the new built form is scaled appropriately in relation to that host building, all those questions will be reconsidered by Stephen Avery. I don't know how closely he follows the OVGA process these days, but obviously that's a statutory process that's foreign to us, and so I will be observing it with great interest, but we don't know what's going to come out the other side. It's often why the heritage permit is sought first, but there's absolutely no reflection on the applicant for doing it this way around. It's entirely within their rights to do so. And as Mr. Connors acknowledged, if a Section 72 has to be sought in future, so be it. So it is difficult to separate out those heritage matters, but we have to do it because our job today is only to consider the planning permit, the application for a planning permit. And I do agree that it's a very high quality building. I also agree that it's the most over-engineered intersection in Melbourne, but it's also one of the most flood-prone. It's a swimming pool in winter, and the difficulties in designing on this site don't only go to heritage, they go to the 1.65-metre drain that's underneath the western end of the site. They go to a really demanding approach to the finished floor levels to make sure that the new building is resilient to future floods. And I think that with all of those considerations in mind, the design outcome is really, really impressive. And we've added more conditions back into the mix, including around making sure there's an easement to get in and out of that drain, and that design response keeps getting finessed and improved. And with some really challenging constraints, especially around the lower levels, actually what we've seen here is a really high quality outcome. So it is well and truly pushing the envelope in terms of the discretionary density and height controls. But the reason we should be tolerating that here is because of the extraordinary difficulty on site, coupled with the extraordinary high quality design resolution that we're considering, coupled with the fact that that all has a big caveat on it, that the heritage process might dictate a rewrite as well. But let's be honest, conserving that building is not a cheap matter, and this proposal as a whole is something that's worthy of support. And let's see what happens with the heritage process and whether we need to visit it again. But the designs are very, very high quality, so I think a permit should issue.
Thank you, Councillor Leppett. Do any other councillors wish to speak for or against the motion? In that case, I'll put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hand. I declare that carried unanimously. All right, the next agenda item before us is agenda item 6.3, the Carlton Heritage Review and Punt Road Oval Planning Scheme Amendment C405. Do any councillors have a conflict in regards to this item? Councillor Ball?
Yes, I have conflict in relation to a building that is affected by this proposed overlay, contains within it an apartment that's co-owned by a person that was on the same ticket as me at the 2020 election and also contributed financially to the campaign.
Councillor Leppett?
I have exactly the same conflict.
All right, and I have a conflict as well due to my employment at the University of Melbourne, and one of the buildings covered in this report is indeed Earth Sciences Building at the University of Melbourne.
Thanks, so Deputy Lord Mayor.
Lord Mayor.
Thank you. I am just in waiting. I can ask the question, would any councillors like a presentation in relation to this item? No, thank you. If we could just ask for the motion to come up. We did have an amendment that we put in this afternoon, Jordan. Yep, that's the one. Thank you. Well, I'm going to move this motion this evening. I'm looking for a seconder to the motion. Thanks, Councillor Griffiths. Well, I'm delighted to endorse the next steps in our Carlton Heritage Review tonight. I know that, like many people, I certainly enjoy walking around the Carlton neighbourhood and seeing that juxtaposition of heritage and modern, and protecting that heritage story is important. This has already been a significant process, and I acknowledge the work of our team in pulling together the review and then going through the processes And importantly, this last phase has been to engage with and consider feedback from our community. So a very important phase of the work. Tonight, we are considering those submissions and what we send through from public consultation for review by the independent panel appointed by the Minister for Planning. And this will bring the amendment C405 closer to incorporation into the planning scheme. I'm calling out a couple of submissions in particular. One was from the Carlton Residents Association, and as a result, we've made some changes to the heritage classification of several properties following their feedback, and grateful for the time and effort they put in to stress test the team's work overall and make some further suggestions. And I also note the submission we've received from the National Trust and Music Victoria regarding the John Curtin Hotel. Some of that's been in the press lately, and our team are recommending amending the statement of significance to fully recognise the Curtin Hotel's historic use as a live music venue, which I wholeheartedly support, and it gives you a sense of the breadth of uses as well as physical form through the review. Finally, I'm noting that we are still waiting for the Minister to approve our interim heritage controls for Carlton through Amendment C404. I note we've got a new Minister, so we are urging the Minister to approve those controls as soon as possible, so that there can be certainty whilst we wait on the permanent controls to come through this Amendment C405. Thanks very much to our team, and I'm really delighted to support this motion this evening, and to you, Councillor Griffiths, as seconder. Thanks.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. It's certainly my pleasure to second this motion and to reiterate your thanks to the team and everyone who's made submissions in light of this plan along the way. There's been a huge amount of work go into it, obviously. We've noted that in previous motions as this work has been done, but again, it's right to say thank you to the team who put all of the time and effort in from Council and from Lovell Chen, and as you quite rightly point out, everyone who's made submissions. It was fantastic to walk along Lygon Street this morning and to see the energy and excitement that's returning to that street, new coffee shops amongst other things, but to see those placed in the context of some wonderful heritage buildings. I'm not going to play a game with you, Lord Mayor, as to who has spent more time at the John Curtin Hotel and feels its significance more in their heart out of you and I, but it's fantastic to have received the submissions that discuss that hotel. It's fantastic to see that officers have accepted that recommendation, and I note that that is the place that my son played his first ever game of pinball. So there you go. It holds a very special place in my heart as well. For all of the work that's gone into this along the way and for all of the reasons that you've stated, Lord Mayor, I'm happy to second the motion and commend it to the meeting.
Thank you, Councillor Griffiths. Good discussion after the meeting. I look to see if there are any other speakers to the motion. Then I'm going to put that motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous. So we declare that motion carried. Well done, team. And we can ask our councillors to return to the meeting. Thank you. Going to celebrate. Welcome. Welcome back. We're just expecting Councillor Dr. Ball. Oh, there she is. Good. All right. Well, as our councillors take their seats, thanks, councillors. We're moving on to agenda item 6.4, which is the Draft Domestic Animal Management Plan 21 to 2025. I'm wondering if councillors would like a presentation on this item. Questions, that would be good as well. Over to you. Thanks, Councillor Leppett.
Thank you very much, Lord Mayor. I think my questions are to Linda Weatherson, but I'll just ask them and they can be fielded as they come. So Section 68A of the Domestic Animals Act says that we
as the council must set out a method for evaluating whether the animal control services provided by the council in its municipal district are adequate to give effect to the requirements to this Act and the regulations. And that's something we've got to put in the Domestic Animal Management Plan, the draft of which we're considering today. So I just want a little bit of information about the level of resources, if I could, where the report mentions that we have a team of four. I'm wondering how long that's been in place. And I'm also wondering, given that we've just created seven new dog off-leash areas, a new dog prohibited area, and we've always got the ongoing issue with dangerous dogs and managing animal businesses, is that level of resources adequate? And should there be a trigger in the management plan to review that? There's three questions in there. I might just let you respond, but thank you, Linda. Thanks.
Thanks, Councillor Leppert. The first question I'll answer is in relation to how long the current resource level has been in place, and it is about a decade. So up until now, that has, or still, that is, has been adequate, while it's sometimes pressed, but we have managed. The second question around, given the new seven parks, or dogs off-leash parks, will that continue to be adequate? Have we got enough resources? We don't know yet. We can anticipate that we may not, but what we will be doing is collecting data. The welfare of both animals and their owners and other people in parks is very important to us, of course. So we'll be collecting data, and then if not adequate, we will work with resources internally, the administration, to ensure that adequate resources are applied to animal management to comply with the Act. There was a third question?
Your answers nevertheless covered it, so thank you. That's okay. Great.
Thanks, Linda. Any other questions at this point? None. Okay, thank you. Then I'm calling on a councillor to move this motion that we see on the screen. Yep. Councillor Dr. Ball, thank you. And a councillor to second the motion. Councillor Hakim, over to you, Councillor Dr. Ball. Thanks.
Thank you very much. This plan and thank you to all of you who remain tonight, both staff and residents, legends, all. This plan will cover the next 3 years, and it has, as its context, as we've just heard, six, possibly seven, somebody's wrong, but the report says there are six new off-leash parks, three of which are time limited, that is, you can't have your dog off-leash at any time of day, but only after 6 p.m. and until 8 a.m. and in the context also of a 64% increase in dog and cat registrations over the last 4 years, and probably there are many more than that that are not registered, and we know the reasons for that. Everyone's getting a dog and a cat in lockdown. And also in the context of complaints about barking are at an all-time high, and there's other, of course, nuisances and concerns and dangers posed by poor animal management. So this plan seeks to, of course, to address those and other concerns of the public, and to encourage in all ways responsible pet ownership, of course. That includes de-sexing your pets, and there are concessions, subsidies for concession card holders to help pay for the cost of de-sexing. And we encourage an early socialisation and training of dogs, community education around the safety, how to be safe around dogs, especially for children, of course, how to deal approach dogs. And as has already been intimated, the increased patrolling of public spaces to ensure that all dogs are suitably controlled, because this is a concern we take very seriously. That's enough for me, because this is not a final report. It is a draft report that is now to be put to council, and if adopted in its draft form, will go to consultation by the community. So I encourage all those of you here stalwarts that remain here tonight and online to engage with this plan if you have an interest in pet ownership and the safety of our public realm. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Dr. Ball. Councillor Hakim is seconder.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and thank you, Councillor Dr. Ball. First, I'd like to say thanks to the team. Thanks, Linda Dean, and all our team in this space for your work. It is very important work because pets are truly a part of the family in every family where we have pets. And as shared, there's been an increase in the number of pets through the pandemic, and the part that they play in our well-being is very much well documented. I have a cat myself, Jasmine, and de-sexing is very important. She likes to fly, but she doesn't like to leave the house, where cats should really be creatures that kill about 1 million birds a day, as we know. But all these things are the things we talk about and kind of engage, and very important around how we can ensure we can support pets in our municipality, particularly with this increase and with space being continually limited. So I commend this draft report and motion to you, councillors.
Thanks, Councillor Hakim. Any other speakers to this motion? Councillor Lippitt, thank you.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. I agree as well, and thank the team for putting together this draft, and it will come back to us, so I'll acknowledge that this is not the final version, so I'll just be brief. The amendment's mine, and I want to thank the mover and seconder for agreeing to move it in this form. I just want to make sure that the investigation into the into council making an order for the mandatory de-sexing of cats concludes before we have to start consultation on the next damp. Not that I'll be here. I know I keep saying that, but I'm on the public record again. I won't be here. I just think it's better timing to make sure that when we do develop the damps, we're not just writing a new update document because the Act tells us we have to every 4 years, but we actually take the opportunity to think quite strategically and about resources as well. So I also want to acknowledge the team, which does an absolutely extraordinary job. The number of cats and dogs, which are the only animals that this Act concerns itself with, have doubled in the time that our team has not increased, if the decade is accurate. So my hypothesis, not that I'm the chief executive of this organisation and it's not up to me or any other councillor to decide what the resource levels are, but my hypothesis is that our team must be so efficient to be getting on with their job, but they are possibly going to be facing even more work in future, and we might need a few more animal management officers. The reason I say that is during COVID, as Councillor Ball mentioned, the pressure on open space in particular for dog off-leash and on-leash for that matter, but also the threat of dangerous dogs and what that means when they interact with the public means that we need our animal management team and our rangers for that matter out there educating the public so that we're not only ever responding to formal complaints, because I think once you do that, that's when you recognise that something's gone wrong, when actually in an ideal world, as we expand these dog off-leash areas, we'd play a really important education role there as well. And that's a job that our animal management team does, but so do our park rangers. But they do an extraordinary job, so I want to acknowledge their work. And just flag that the resource in question, because under the Act we do have to figure out if our resources are adequate to meet our statutory obligations, and the one that hasn't been mentioned today is investigating animal businesses, and there are four in the municipality, making sure that we're doing that and meeting our obligations under the Act. So it's a question I'm sure that will continue to be asked, including when this comes back for the final version, but let's see what comes back.
Good. Thanks, Councillor Lippitt. Any other speakers to the motion? None? Okay. Well, we're putting the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. Unanimous. We declare that motion carried. Thank you. This brings us to item 6.5. 5, which is the proposed naming of VH08 as Yennanung Quay in Docklands. Would councillors like a presentation on this item? No. Then I'm calling on a councillor to move the motion. Thanks, Councillor Dr. Ball. It's been a busy night. And seconder, Councillor Hakim, thank you. Back to you, Councillor Dr. Ball.
Thank you very much. This is a simple naming motion for an area that has hitherto been VH08, which I think we can all agree we could improve on. The proposed name has partly come from the community, which suggested it be called a quay. It's a Dockland area, waterside area in Docklands, which thank you to the council business team, has put on the screen to demonstrate the map where the area that we're talking about in the Docklands. And the community suggested it be called a quay. And we, council approached the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung Cultural Heritage Aboriginal Corporation to propose an Aboriginal name from the Woiwurrung language, which they have kindly done. Auntie Gail Smith has kindly proposed the name. Well, she gave two names, but we are suggesting Yennanung. And I do apologise if I have mispronounced that. I have we have sought to confirm the correct pronunciation, and I cannot confirm it at this stage. So don't literally quote me on the pronunciation. But we are very, very grateful to the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung Cultural Heritage Aboriginal Corporation for supplying this name, and it is very fitting that it should reference the ancient place that is the Docklands and Naam more generally. This word, we're told, means waterways, and hence it's appropriate. So it is. We welcome having a First Nations name for a new place that, in fact, is an ancient place. And I commend it to you, Yennanung Quay.
Thanks, Councillor Dr. Ball. Councillor Hakim.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and thank you, Councillor Dr. Ball. Thanks for everyone who took part of this proposal. Names play such an important role. They are part of our community, and they do bring that link back to community, place and culture. And that's something that Councillor Dr. Ball shared. This very much is one that celebrates country, culture and the language of the Wurundjeri people, the Woiwurrung language, and takes two parts with the word and the Docklands community involvement with Quay. So it also recognises that link to maritime and waterways, and that's an important part in our history, both ancient and more recent. So I look forward to this recently reactivated ferry terminal that is there as well, and to see that continue to grow and to take a place of pride in our water gateway to the city. And I put this motion to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Councillor Hakim. Are there any other speakers to this motion this evening? None? Deputy Lord Mayor.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. I'm just indicating that I'm looking forward to voting for this motion in a moment. Indeed, we at the City of Melbourne have big plans for what was previously known as VH08, but as Yennanung Quay, we do hope that it will become a very busy, bustling commuter and sightseeing ferry terminal. Yennanung Quay will become something which is a household word and name in Melbourne and Victoria and indeed across Australia and beyond. We should also point out that the Woiwurrung language is a language which is considered endangered. And so one important way that we can preserve First Nation languages is by incorporating some traditional language names into our place names, and that's what we're doing this evening, and I think that's a really positive thing.
Thanks, Deputy Lord Mayor. We are going to put this motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. Unanimous, we declare that motion carried. Thank you. Item 6.6 is funding for the community grocer. Any presentation required on this item? That's a no. I'm looking for a mover, Councillor Dr. Ball, and a seconder, Councillor Hakim. Back to you, Councillor Dr. Ball.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to move this motion. You, those of you who are keen observers or perhaps were there on the night, we had an appeal from the community grocer to an FMC meeting recently explaining how this social enterprise, which is operating a weekly market on the Carlton public housing estate, experienced great difficulties during the pandemic. It was obliged to move its location multiple times, and of course during lockdown had to close, so nobody knew where it was or when it was open, and of course it lost its customer base in that time. But we are very keen to support this social enterprise, which is working to alleviate food insecurity. And we know from our surveys and research data here in the City of Melbourne that food insecurity has risen to alarming levels during the pandemic, alongside poverty, of course, which is now, not sure where this date comes from, 2020 was one in three residents of this municipality experienced food insecurity. So this is something we can't, the community grocer, we can't afford let fall by the wayside. This is once-off funding, which we are delighted to support this hugely important community organisation to get back on its feet, and it comes with clear performance criteria. So we really look forward to seeing the Carlton market, because there are other markets run by the community grocer, but this one in a very important key location in the City of Melbourne reopen and thrive again. I commend it to you.
Thank you, Councillor Dr. Ball. Councillor Hakim.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and thank you, Councillor Dr. Ball. I called this in because I think it's really important for us to be able to close the loop. This did come up in our budget submissions and part of recognising the needs of our community. So I want to thank Linda and the team for spending the time with community and having those conversations and going through the due process from this submission. We know that as the cost of living continues to increase, one of the things, and I fear, and we've seen this in this one in three with people who are having food insecurity in the stats in 2020, that food relief will become even more important. So that's something that's really critical, that we support the foundations that allow that to happen while we all work towards stronger parts of our community so that this doesn't, that this improves. This grocer, this community grocer, is a space for everyone, and we know from hearing from our Carlton community that it's something that is important for them, and consistency of funding and being able to support this is a really positive outcome, and I put this motion to you, councillors.
Thanks, Councillor Hakim. Are there any other speakers to this motion on community grocer? I'm putting it to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. That one is unanimous as well. Thank you very much, councillors. This moves us on to agenda item 6.7, opportunity for international engagement. Would anybody like a presentation on this item? None. Then I'm calling on a councillor to move the motion. Deputy Lord Mayor, thank you. And a seconder, Councillor Leppett. Over to you, Deputy Lord Mayor. Thanks.
Thanks, Lord Mayor, and pleased to be able to speak in favour of this motion. My only regret is that Chris Thrum isn't here this evening to address us, but I do see that he has submitted an item of correspondence to us on this matter, strongly endorsing your attendance. Indeed, look, the City of Melbourne has a long history of attendance at C40 conferences, and there's very good reason for that. Represents some 25% of the global economy and 700 million people worldwide, and represents cities which are really world-leading cities and in a whole range of areas, including the efforts to make our cities sustainable. I'm delighted, Lord Mayor, that you'll get the opportunity to showcase some of the exciting things we're doing at the City of Melbourne, including our Power Melbourne initiative to electrify our city, as well as our urban greening projects. And also you'll get the opportunity to learn from the world's best in terms of what we can do to make our cities more sustainable. I do note that Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, is currently the chair of the C40 Cities Group. I do hope you get the chance to catch up with him and compare the economic recovery of London post COVID with efforts here in Melbourne, because I think there's lessons on both sides there. So very happy to support this motion.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. To you, Councillor Lippitt. Thanks.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. I'm happy to support the motion as well. And it's vital that our fearless leader be there. This is going to be the biggest gathering for C40 since before the pandemic. And it's a really important opportunity to share that knowledge, but also have those key discussions around what a jobs-rich, climate-friendly recovery looks like. There's a lot of information to learn. There's a lot of information to impart to others. But that collaboration is why it's so vital to be there. So I wish you well, Lord Mayor, and thank you for representing us.
Thank you, Councillor Lippitt. Would anybody like to speak to this item? No, I'm putting the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous. We declare that motion carried. Thanks, councillors. Well, this concludes reports from management this evening, and we do have one item of general business for consideration, which is agenda item 7.1, Councillor Campbell injecting room in the City of Melbourne. I know that we have some requests to speak on this, and they're coming in via Zoom. And Bon Nguyen is the first of our speakers to present this evening. So I'm just looking at our tech team to make sure we're ready for that. Okay, good to go. Welcome, Bon.
Thank you, Lord Mayor and Deputy Lord Mayor and councillors, and thank you for the opportunity to speak on an important matter. I am the president for the Vietnamese community, and in my role, I have actually, I am in full support of our fellow Australian, particularly for those who are vulnerable. But I don't think that actually having it in the city, having the injection room in the city would help that our fellow Australians. I would like to bring to your attention, in the end of the day, you are the people that will make the decision. And I have enjoyed the City of Melbourne for a number of years. And I don't live in the City of Melbourne, but City of Melbourne is actually, I consider is my it's a home to many of us. Okay, but I would like to bring it to your attention of what I know about Richmond, North Richmond, where the 7 injection rooms has been implemented. Well, prior to the implementation of the 7 injection room, I think that people can say safely that they can actually walk down Victoria Street and enjoy the culture aspect and the environment around them without much fearing. After the implementation of Victoria Street, we think that there are issues that has been deeply impact to the local members, to the local constituents, as well as actually to business surroundings. Now, these are the following things that the people have actually, I have been witness to, and also that actually by speaking with the local resident, they have brought to my attention. They found needles even at the banks, okay? I have, on several occasions, I have found that actually paper was actually collapsing on the strip and where ambulance was actually needed. There was cases where a resident was saying that people was urinating and pooing in front of their house as well. People was doing shoot up in front of their front yard as well. So those kind of things would actually impact people culturally and socially interaction, would drive people out. And when I speak with the business in the area, it has impacted them deeply. A lot of business has been driving out business. This is actually post-COVID, and more so with COVID being impacted as well. Not only the business people, but I myself, on one of the occasions when I was actually having food in one of the restaurants, there was actually a vulnerable member of our society has come in into the restaurant and asked for food. I was a key witness to that. So it was actually raised a lot of concerns and fear among the people, the patron in the restaurant. And I'm sure that that's the feeling around the Victoria Street as well. I love Melbourne. I love to be able to walk down there safely. This is, and I would not want any impact the City of Melbourne. And I would like to end it right there. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Bon. Perfect timing as well. Thanks for making your points strongly this evening. We appreciate that. I know we now have Chrissy Maynard also joining us via Zoom, and Chrissy is going to speak to us now.
Hi, can you hear me?
Welcome, Chrissy, loud and clear. Thank you.
Hi, wonderful. Thank you, everyone. I myself am a resident of Richmond and have been for 25 years now. I have huge concerns for what's going to transpire if this room is open. As I said in my submission, I came down and spoke to a lot of the businesses in that area last year, and a lot of the businesses had been there for a long time. I'm really concerned because the businesses on Victoria Street, those people have all migrated here, have been here for a very long time. And if any of you have been down to Victoria Street, you'll see there's graffitied shop fronts everywhere. No, none of us go down there, the residents, which is a shame because we used to frequent there at least once a month. It's too unsafe, and as a person with children, I can't see that any of you could support a room that, will bring this environment into people who have, had a livelihood for so long. It is very scary what could happen with, obviously, a Flinders Street across the road. It's such an easy avenue for people to use public transport, hop off, do their business, and then hop back on the train. So we understand that over 80% of the people that come to Richmond to either use the injecting room in Richmond or to get their drug paraphernalia there aren't from Richmond. And that's, a huge consideration here. I understand. It's horrible what we've gone through around here, and it does worry me a lot that these people that are in business or that are residents in the area are going to have to go through the same thing as what we've been through.
Chrissy, thanks very much for participating this evening, and again, your points have been strongly made and understood. Thank you very much. We now I'm calling on Councillor Campbell to move your motion. Councillor Campbell.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I'll just ask for it to be brought up on the screen, given it's subject to some amendments.
Right.
Thank you.
Sorry, Councillor Campbell, I was just reading that. I think we're all having a look. I'm calling on Councillor Chang to second the motion.
Yes.
Good. And then back to you, Councillor Campbell, as the mover. Thanks.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I'm moving this motion in response to the crippling uncertainty that traders and residents in our city have now been under for years as to whether or not the state government will open a CBD injecting room and where it will be located. To be clear, they were told that they would receive the Kenlay report by the middle of last year. We're now told by the Premier they won't even have that report until early next year. And they want this council to be their champion and call on the state government to finally reveal the plan for a CBD injecting room. Our city has been economically devastated by COVID. We still have over 20% of our shop fronts vacant. Weekday pedestrian traffic is 50% of what it was prior to COVID. And a survey of our businesses early this year found that 74% were either under intense distress or just surviving. We cannot expect them to continue to invest in this city if the state government leaves them in limbo as to whether or not it's going to open an injecting room on their doorstep. And having observed the North Richmond experience, they're understandably concerned about the impacts, as are residents. That's why this motion calls both for the Kenlay report to be urgently released and for the Lord Mayor to make that request, or the current draft, if that can't be done. But it also calls for an independent review of the impacts of the North Richmond room on residents, businesses, and the impacts on safety and amenity. Because without that evidence, this council is not going to be in a position to negotiate with the state government about any proposed location or how to reduce the impacts if the state government decides to proceed with an injecting room in the City of Melbourne. We've received a number of submissions in relation to this motion. One from a resident in North Melbourne who lives 500 metres from the injecting room. He shares witnessing a death in the street from someone he knew to use the room, having his car smashed, damage to his property, being stolen from, being threatened. He says Victoria Street, where he used to go, is now a no-go zone. We've received a submission from a trader who operated a small business in North Richmond for over 20 years. He submits that his business declined by 50% in the 18 months after the injecting room opened and strongly calls for an independent review of the North Richmond injecting room. Another submitter, who resides near North Richmond injecting room, says there's now a highly visible drug market in his residential area, in his gardens, in the streets surrounding him, in footpaths, parks and shopping precincts. Finally, I want to talk about a submission we received from Bill Lang of Small Business Australia, because he was consulted by Ken Lay 14 months ago. He hasn't heard since. And he asks us not to kick this issue down the road. He asks us if we can look in the eyes of any small business owner right now and honestly ask them how they feel about still not knowing years later what the state government's plans are for a CBD injecting room. I don't want to kick this issue down the road. The Ken Lay report is over a year late. The Premier now says we don't even get to see it till next year. And his reason is so that Mr. Lay can consult further with state government bodies, Ambulance Victoria and Victoria Police. I haven't spoken to a single resident or trader who has asked for that work to be done. They're sick of being kept in the dark for years, and they want answers now. Our city's residents and traders have had it tough enough after the last 2 years. If this state government is committed to the economic recovery of this city, it's time for it to come clean on its plans for a CBD injecting room.
Thanks, Councillor Campbell. Councillor Cheng.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. Thank you, Councillor Campbell, for your words. As a trader of the CBD myself, I know the struggles that we're all going through, and the last thing we do need, well, we've already debated the injecting room, and I think the public's well aware of my stance and opposition to it. But I think now what we need is certainty from the state government about where and if they're going to open a safe injecting room. I think the city is struggling still, as we know. We need to provide a safe environment for traders, for residents, students, tourists. When they come to our city, they want to see a clean, safe city. And we do need this confirmation and report to be released so that we know what is going on. I think that's what we're all living in that limbo. I think no resident, no student, no trader who's investing their life savings to open a business in the city wants to live with that uncertainty hanging over their head, which is why I'm seconding this motion. And yeah.
Thank you, Councillor Cheng. Other speakers to this motion? Councillor Dr. Ball?
I just wanted to foreshadow that my intention to move an alternative motion only in the event if this substantive motion fails to pass.
Thanks, Councillor Dr. Ball. Other speakers to this motion? Councillor Griffiths.
Lord Mayor, with the microphone on. Thank you. don't get too ahead of yourself there. Thank you, Lord Mayor, for the opportunity to speak to this motion. It's not a motion that I'll be supporting. It's a motion that I'll be voting against for pretty much exactly the same reasons that I voted against the motion that was brought by Councillor Campbell on the safe injecting room last year. I could repeat most of the points that I made at that time last year. I spoke at some length. I'm not going to go through them all because I think that nothing substantive has changed since that time in terms of the medical and scientific evidence that backs up a need for safe injecting facilities. And I think that while I leave it up to Mr. Lay and the state government, it's obviously their decision as to where best in the City of Melbourne they would be placed, that I would certainly be in favour of such a facility in the city. And I think that's something that does need to be restated. The only thing that I would repeat from the comments that I made last year relate to the comments that I made about the many parents that I met who had lost children to drug overdoses in the roles that I had had previously working for the state government as a senior advisor on mental health, alcohol and other drugs to two different ministers of health and mental health. And that was an undertaking, a statement that I made, that in speaking to those parents, many of whom said to me that they never imagined a scenario where they would be coming to government and lobbying for a safe injecting room, because they never thought that their children would ever be in a situation where they would be injecting drug users. And unfortunately, despite the fact that wasn't the future that they anticipated, they ended up losing children to overdoses. And I said last year, and I say again, that to those parents who came and shared their most harrowing stories, that I listened to them then, and I'm thinking of them at that motion, I'm thinking of them again tonight when I'm thinking about how I will vote on this matter. This is a motion that's been put to us in the guise of not being a motion about supporting or rejecting a safe injecting room in the City of Melbourne, and I recognise that, but very clearly the kinds of submissions that we've had tonight haven't recognised that. So the debate has once again emerged, whether that was the intention or not, around whether a safe injecting room in the city is appropriate or not. And I think it is appropriate. The more substantive part that has been spoken of by the movers tonight has been in how we approach advocating for small business, being champions of small business in the City of Melbourne, about how we describe what's happening as we move through the post-COVID environment, and about how it is that we can encourage further growth as opposed to seeing a negative impact on the city. And I think it's a really important and vital question. I think it's an important and vital question because of the time and effort that we as a council are putting in to regenerating the city. That's from the workers. I know it's shared by councillors here, but it's also shared by the enormous amount of effort that small business owners themselves are putting in every day in the city. And I commend them for that work. I know it's difficult. I know what it's like to start a business and have a business at the commencement of COVID-19 and not have one at the end. That's been an experience that I've been through. But I really want to emphasise that there's a choice now about how we talk about the city going forward, that we have an opportunity in this forum and other places to be leaders and to foster the green shoots that are emerging in the city, or we have the opportunity to talk about the city and what's occurring there in negative ways. And it's worth saying that there are people out there doing that. And I want to give a couple of examples of that tonight because I think it's important. I think it's important to set the context of stating a press release that came out from the Victorian opposition last Tuesday afternoon, as I understand it, where the Shadow Minister for Mental Health, Emma Keely, was speaking about the safe injecting room and saying that the Victorian government was keeping Victorians in the dark about the safe injecting room, and said, amongst other things, local traders, police and Melbourne City Council have rejected Labor's disastrous plan for its second injecting room. That's a direct quote. So I think it is important that we think about restating our positions in light of quotes like that. That was a press release that was on the 9th of August. On the 11th of August, as people might have already seen out in the Liberal Party social media and Twitter, they erected a headstone for the City of Melbourne, declaring that it was dead. The next day, the same afternoon, a team of paramedics working outside the town hall saying that the CBD needed CPR. This is how the Liberal Party chooses to represent what's happening in the City of Melbourne. the day after that, the Photoshop team went one better and declared that there were now ghost trains running through the city of Melbourne. This is how some people choose to represent what is happening in the city at the moment. And I think it is intensely damaging. And I think it's worth saying, because I know both here in the room tonight, certainly via the stream that we have going out, that there are small businesses out there wanting to hear from us what we think is happening in the city of Melbourne. And I know that if I was running a business in a small business in the city of Melbourne, I wouldn't want to see headlines like that. I wouldn't want to see that message being given to families in the suburbs deciding where they're going to go on the weekends. I wouldn't want that being the message that was being transmitted out to the regions when people are thinking about what they're going to do during the school holidays, Christmas holidays and things like that coming up. I wouldn't want that being the message which is being broadcast around the world, a message which I presume is being done in light of the fact that there are elections down the road. And I don't want to see 4 or 5 months of these kinds of messages going out there. In conclusion, what I'd like to say is that we have the opportunity to be a welcoming and generous city, a city that cares for people who run small businesses, a city that cares for people who live here, whether that be in houses or whether that's people who've moved down from the country and are living rough on the streets. We have the opportunity to be a positive and generous city, and that's what I want to see happening, and that's why I can't accept the motion that's before us tonight.
Thanks, Councillor Griffiths. Looking to see if there are any other speakers to this motion before us. Councillor Dr. Ball.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I don't wish to contribute to the debate on this substantive motion, but I do wish to read into the record a submission from a local North Richmond resident who has asked me to read out her submission because she wishes to remain anonymous for fear of reprisals against her family. And she writes, "My family and I have lived in North Richmond for 18 years, 150 metres from the MSIR. Our child attended Richmond West Primary School from 2013 to 2019. We view the MSIR as a welcome and successful solution to the previously anguished community of North Richmond. The facility is a welcome acknowledgement to decades of drug-related issues surrounding our community and to the suffering, those suffering from addiction. This is a medical facility that has vastly improved our neighbourhood. The lives of the vulnerable and reduced antisocial behaviour in the aligning streets for residents. There is a reduction in the all too common and harrowing overdoses and deaths in our streets. There has been a shift from the previously hidden and constant stream of those suffering with addiction sheltering in our laneways, courtyards and vacant properties to inject drugs. There are now support networks for a highly visible and realistic reality of the distressing drug culture that residents know has always existed. It has highlighted the entrenched and distressing drug culture previously ignored by governments from all political parties for decades. The MSIR has relieved our everyday anguish as residents. It has offered the safety of supervised drug use, hope and opportunities for rehabilitation and support to the previously vulnerable. It is finally forcing government leaders to face the hard decisions associated with addiction and mental health related issues. I am asking government leaders to support and expedite the opening of a second and third MSIR in locations where the evidence shows it is needed, not in some out-of-way location where it won't be accessible to those who need it. One MSIR in this city is not enough. I rebut the online outrage and headlines opposed to the MSIR in the media. I confidently state that these opinions do not represent the large cohort of families from the local primary school or neighbours in my networks. Importantly, those hysterical opinions do not reflect the views of many of the children who attended the school between 2013 and 2019. These children are becoming the young, free and critical thinkers of tomorrow. It is difficult to convince a generation who have grown up sidestepping syringes and antisocial behaviour in North Richmond that the MSIR is to blame for drug-related issues. These are children doing great things for the community with empathy and intelligence. not viewing life solely through a privileged lens. They are part of a community that pushes back on the stigmatisation of those less fortunate. In conclusion, she writes, it has taken a pandemic to bring forth the shortcomings of our response to mental health issues, including addiction. Those of us who lived in North Richmond during this time understand now more than ever that the MSIR is an essential service. Melbourne needs to open more in other suburbs with haste that must not be stigmatised by outrage from the Murdoch media. These centres and the compassionate staff should be applauded for providing successful, essential medical services for those in need until we find a better solution to the ongoing drug crisis. Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Dr. Ball. Any other speakers to this motion? Councillor Louis.
Thank you very much, Lord Mayor. Can I thank Councillor Campbell, Councillor Chang, and the submitters. I'll be very brief. I want to repeat, what has been said so far. I'm in support of the Councillor Campbell's motion. I also I feel for the welfare of the marginalised and also those affected by drugs as well. But I'm also concerned about, as stipulated in the motion, not just the businesses, but the people who put their livelihood in buying property, residential or otherwise, in an area where a proposed injecting room may be located. I have spoken to people that have property around the North Richmond area who have done valuations and have concerns about what those figures are. We're talking about monetary values, but there are people talk about on Victoria Street, the before and after. Before the injecting room and after the injecting room. A number of them have gone now. So those shops have been vacated, the business have closed. I'm yet to be convinced that an injecting room in the city of Melbourne, especially when we're in the recovery phase after COVID, is the right solution. And I'm concerned that I don't want to leave a legacy for something that may not be a positive continuing outlet or facility that Melbourne will benefit from. I'm able to be convinced, but I'm just worried from reading and talking to people in the North Richmond, understanding that this is proposed to be a different one in the Melbourne CBD, but I've concerns about whichever system that will go in place. But I'm happy to support Councillor Campbell and Councillor Chang. Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Louis. Any other speakers? Noting that we have a foreshadowed motion, but Councillor Campbell, for your right of reply. Yep.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. At the outset, I want to thank Councillor Dr. Ball for reading the submission, the anonymous submission she did, because it highlights the need for this independent report into what the impacts have been on North Richmond. We've heard a number of publicly written submissions. We've heard from two submitters orally tonight about how the North Richmond community has been devastated. And Councillor Ball has put before us a very different account. And the only way this council can get to the bottom of that, to understand whether North Richmond has been a positive impact on residents and businesses and safety and amenity, is to commission this independent review. And if this council refuses to do that tonight and continues to support the safe injecting room, which is the majority of councillors' current position, we are turning a blind eye to evidence that we have a duty to have before us. In light of the fact there are these differing opinions, in the absence of an independent review confirming the impacts on amenity, we as a council cannot be satisfied that we won't have the same circumstance repeat in our city if the state government proceeds to open an injecting room. The other aspect of this motion calls for the urgent release of the Kenleigh report. I referred tonight to the fact that report was due in the middle of last year. That's wrong. The state government said that report would be handed down at the end of 2020. The report will be over 2 years, almost 3 years late by the time we get it. No trader who's suffering mortgage stress, who's struggling to make repayments, who doesn't know whether to keep holding on, deserves that uncertainty. And if we're not going to champion them, I don't know what we're doing here.
Thanks, Councillor Campbell. Are there any other speakers to the motion? No. Then I'm going to put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. Councillor Campbell, Councillor Louis, Councillor Chang, thank you. All those against, raise your hands. Councillor Leppert, Councillor Dr. Ball, Councillor Hakim, Deputy Lord Mayor Sellicap, and Councillor Griffiths. So that motion is not carried. I call on Councillor Dr. Ball to move the foreshadowed motion as it appears on the screen.
Thank you.
Giving us time to have a look at it
very much.
So moved.
Thank you.
Calling on a councillor to second.
Well, Mayor, we might need to scroll through so people can read it, because I think people are seeing it for the first time. So can we just scroll slowly from top to bottom so that both the public and those online can have the opportunity to read it, please?
There's two words that should be removed from the pre-motion that's just left the screen. 1.2, as it should be deleted after the words North Richmond. Thank you.
Okay, that is the motion put. Looking for a seconder to that motion. Councillor Hakim, thank you. Back to you, Councillor Dr. Ball.
Thank you very much. This alternate motion derives from a vision for our city where everybody enjoys respect, compassion and care and can get the help and healthcare they need when they need it. We have heard various first-person testimonies tonight, both in support of and against the first MSIR in North Richmond, and this cannot usefully be a contest of anecdotes. I accept that. However, we do have evidence to rely on assessing the success of the first MSIR in North Richmond, and in essence, that the purpose of a MSIR or MSIS, it means the same thing, a supervised injecting facility, is not a cause of social problems and nuisance. It is intended as a solution. We know from the North Richmond enabling legislation that, unlike any other equivalent facility in the world, that legislation set up that facility in the hope that it would improve amenity. And then an independent panel of experts was commissioned 18 months into what was then a trial to assess its impact, both its health impact, its social impact, and its impact on amenity. It was chosen as a site, North Richmond, because it was the most intensive or dense location for drug use and activity in Victoria. And as I've stated, these aims were ambitious in hoping not only to meet medical needs, healthcare needs, but also improve amenity. The results of that independent panel of experts, which was chaired by Professor Margaret Hamilton of the University of Melbourne, a lifelong expert in drug and alcohol use and rehabilitation, and consists of members including the former police commissioner, Ken Lay, concluded that the trial succeeded in most, but not all, of its objectives. And if I may, it found that there were no overdose deaths in the North Richmond MSIR in its first 18 months, despite 271 extremely serious overdoses. Nobody died. While it was not possible to say with certainty how many people would have died had the facility not been there, modelling based on international experience suggests that at least 21 and up to 27 people would have died had the MSIR not existed in those 18 months. So that's a modelled estimate, obviously. So more than one a month. And we know in the city of Melbourne that about two people a month are overdosing in our municipality every month without an MSIR. The panel found there was a reduction in ambulance attendances due to overdose. It found a reduction in reports of public injecting. It found many of the users accessed other health services and support services, and this motion talks about how the proposed facility for the City of Melbourne will be significantly different from the one in North Richmond, which is a standalone injecting facility. So we can reasonably expect that these outcomes will be even better in the City of Melbourne, and this motion reiterates our support for that condition. The independent panel also found that the MSIR provided screening, assessment and treatment initiation for bloodborne infections, and the control and reduction of hepatitis C, as one example of those, is a key objective of the state government, and it will not achieve that objective without more MSIRs. The independent panel found that certain objectives were not achieved, and that is amenity did not improve. It also found that local people reported no change in sightings of discarded injecting equipment. So we need to recognise that this injecting facility does not cause social problems. It is a proposed, and not adequate, but a proposed solution to social problems. The outcome of this independent expert panel was that there was no net change in the amenity in North Richmond before compared with after the advent of the MSIR. Things did not improve, but neither did things get worse. No net change in amenity. Given that there are other, the report's findings go on, given that there are other parts of the state with high concentrations of injecting drug use and related harms, the panel recommended that the state government open another MSIS or MSIR, and that one site cannot effectively address all the needs for such a service in a city the size of Melbourne. Based on analyses of available data, the panel recommends that the government considers an appropriate location within the city of Melbourne. This is the second highest municipality in the state for drug activity. Ongoing government implementation needs to focus on community safety. This is the findings of the expert independent panel. needs to focus on community safety and amenity in partnership with local government and the community. And after receiving this recommendation, the state government appointed, as we've heard, Mr. Ken Lay, who served on that original panel and which evaluated the North Richmond MSIR, and he has led community consultation. And we now learn in the past week that the state government, whose project this is, wants to hear Ken Lay to include more recent COVID-related data because drug use activity has altered during COVID. So for the recommendation of the location to be best evidence-based practice, we are told he needs the time to incorporate that evidence. We have the evidence is in. We cannot expect this MSIR has not improved amenity in North Richmond, but there is significant drug-related activity in the City of Melbourne which must be addressed. We can save lives, we can deliver essential health care where people need it most, and the other nearest related corollary, other than North Richmond, and the more long-standing of the two, is King's Cross in Sydney. And in the 20 years since the King's Cross supervised injecting facility has been in operation, King's Cross is gentrified. King's Cross has not suffered from that facility. That facility provides essential medical health care to the people who need it most. So thank you for the opportunity to discuss the evidence. We have both been drawing on the evidence tonight, but these are the conclusions of that report.
Thanks, Councillor Dr. Ball. Councillor Hakim.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and thanks, Councillor Dr. Ball, for preparing this alternative motion. I'd also like to thank Councillor Griffith for your comments in the substantive motion that was defeated and for sharing those stories. I think mental health is something we need to continue to always discuss and think about as well. I'd like to start like I did the last time in May 2021 and to recognise that this is a complex issue. And I think we can see that here tonight. The evidence, however, is clear and it's not in question in my mind. Internationally, the experience shows that it clearly works. It is a complex issue. It requires us to approach it with honest and open conversations about alcohol and other drugs. It requires us to recognise the fact that we can't stop the use of alcohol and other drugs. That's simply not realistic. That open conversation is also critical so that the community is able to have certainty, and that's why the motion asks that the Lord Mayor passes on community sentiment to the Minister. It's important to recognise also that people who use drugs should be treated with the same compassion and respond to as anyone else in our community. In fact, we all know a lot of people who use drugs from all walks of life and go on about their day. As part of my induction for a semester of volunteering at the Women's Legal Centre, I remember a banker coming to speak to us about the impact that was on her when she had issues with her dependence on drugs. This is somebody who was successful in their career in banking, and their use of drugs and their dependence on drugs took them down to a path that meant that they were no longer in that profession and their safety was at risk. In Australia, most people agree our attitudes and laws around alcohol and other drugs are based more on politics than common sense. We ultimately need more facts and less sensationalist media coverage. Sensationalism by the media creates stigma. It dehumanises people who use drugs. This stops people who think they need treatment from seeking help, because they feel rejected, they feel alone, they feel ostracised. People who have issues with their alcohol or drug use often have other challenges. This is why a trauma-informed approach is critical. We must consider our role to find better solutions for everyone in our community, not create shame and judgment. and that's why a multidisciplinary approach is important. Doing the same thing we've done does not make any changes, and we must adopt new ways of doing it. We know that innovative approaches mean people can be honest and open about drugs, like pill testing at music festivals, like a medically supervised injecting room. These keep our people and our communities safe. A person who needs help because of drug addiction could be from any background. They can come from any social standing, whether you're a banker, whether you're a lawyer, or whether you work in hospitality. Many of us know people who use drugs. Many know someone who has issues with their use of alcohol and drugs. Ultimately, when we consider things such as this, things that have a stigma, that ultimately has an impact on all of us in some way, and we need to act with compassion and honesty, and to work to ensure we create safe spaces for everyone in our community. Now, let's be clear. Ultimately, the decision about a safe injecting room rests with the state government, including its location. Today, we're asking to reaffirm our position and the importance of having health facilities around the centre, wherever it may be, and to share the sentiment of our community with the minister to ensure that their needs are considered and heard. It recognises that location and timing is critical. Councillors, I commend the motion to you.
Thanks, Councillor Hakim. Any other speakers, to this motion? Councillor Cheng.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I can't in good conscience support this motion. As I stated before, I'm opposed to the injecting room, and yeah, I'll be voting against this motion.
Thanks, Councillor Cheng. Anybody else like to speak to the motion? Councillor Campbell.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I also can't support this motion because it affirms support for this injecting room. And we've heard extensively from Councillor Dr. Ball tonight about the findings from the government's independent panel, which stated there was no impact to amenity in North Richmond. Here are some other things that report also said. There were more heroin-related deaths within 1 kilometre of the North Richmond injecting room in the 12-month period after it opened compared to the 12-month period prior. Now, that report could only consider the 18-month trial period. But what it did find was, although no one died in the injecting room, more people died on the streets around it after it opened. I'm worried about the health of vulnerable people too. But the evidence is in on North Richmond, and this council has decided not to seek further evidence. And that evidence gives us real reason to believe that an injecting room in our CBD means more people dying on our streets. So I won't be voting in favour of this motion.
Thanks, Councillor Campbell. Before right of reply, I'm going to see if there are any other speakers to the motion. I was just going to say a few words. Look, I am on the record on this issue, and I remain supportive of the Council's motion from the 25th of May 2021. That's why I'll be voting in support of this motion. I said that, sorry. Look, I note and respect the debate tonight. It just really captures the sensitivity and also the breadth of views, and thanks for that. For that very respectful debate. Since our debate in May 2021, there really has been no new information received from the Victorian government, apart from the fact that it's going to release a final report early in 2023. It is important to acknowledge, though, that we've got a new health minister responsible for this policy area, and that's why I support this motion in terms of writing to that health minister to reiterate our position, to be able to share feedback that we've had even more recently in the timeframe since the last motion from traders, residents, visitors and workers, and to make our position clear in the various nuances that are set out in this motion this evening. So for those reasons, I'll be supporting the motion. Over to you, Councillor Dr. Ball, I think, is the last speaker on the issue.
Thank you. Just to the right of reply, I just want to make it completely clear that having read the entirety of the independent expert panel's report, which is over 300 pages, there it amasses a huge amount of data and a huge amount of community information, surveys and reporting on what people report seeing and experiencing. So it takes the views of the community and it takes the medical and police data about what has been going on in North Richmond before and after the opening of the MSIR. And it's important to emphasise, while you could pick out from these things reports to say something's got better, something's got worse, something's got better, something's got worse, that would be to misrepresent the conclusions of the report and the expert panel. I cited in full the conclusions and the findings of the panel, and I do not wish to leave anyone in doubt as to the conclusions, having assessed what happened before and after, some things got better, some things got worse, that the health outcomes were improved and that the amenity outcomes did not net alter. Some things got better, some things got worse. There was no net difference taken as a whole, and therefore that expert panel recommended opening of more MSIRs. It wouldn't have made that recommendation if it thought it was a bad thing. These are independent experts with extremely extensive experience commissioned to recommend to government what it should do, and those were its findings based on the evidence, which is entirely available to the public. This report is a public report that everyone can assess for themselves, but those were its conclusions. Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Dr. Ball. I'm going to put this motion to the vote. All those in favour of this motion, Councillor Leppard, Councillor Dr. Ball, Councillor Hakim, Deputy Lord Mayor, Councillor Rees, Lord Mayor, Councillor Capp, Councillor Griffiths. Thank you. All those against the motion, Councillor Campbell, Councillor Louis, Councillor Chang, majority in favour, so that motion as put tonight is passed. Thank you. That concludes the items of general business for consideration this evening. I'm looking to councillors to see if there are any items of urgent business for consideration. No. Then I say to everybody that's still here that we've got 15 minutes of question time. Would anybody like to ask a question? We overstated the earlier one, but let's do it. Please come to the lectern and ask us a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord Mayor and councillors, for this opportunity to be here tonight and see how councillors actually run. It's been very informative and very interesting. On the last debate, I don't want to enter into the debate, but I have some background I won't go into in neuroscience and disability and social problems across Victoria and further than that. And I'm interested in the seemingly linear nature of Ken Lay's report. And I see that the police are being consulted and the ambulance service, so I can see that it's happening on the ground. But I do wonder if very authoritative bodies who have global reach, like Odyssey House, which has a very interesting model operating very successfully in Bairnsdale, where there's a massive drug problem. And I was in on the ground early with that, and then I've watched it roll out extremely successfully. And I think that's worth looking at. And the fantastic work done by the Florey Institute for Neuroscience and Mental Health. And they are world leaders, and they're right on our doorstep. And I think not to consult with those neuroscientists. I've worked alongside with them. I've gone out and talked all over Victoria with them. Eminent neuroscientists, particularly Emeritus Professor Fred Mendelsohn, who brought neuroscience to the Florey, fantastic scientists. And they go out and they speak to Rotary, they speak to Probus, they speak to, you know, people all over Victoria. And I would just urge you to consult with the global authorities we have here in Melbourne. Don't just take one, don't be allow yourselves to be sidelined down this avenue of a narrow report which only looks at things on the ground. Look at global models. There's plenty of them. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sorry, what was your name?
Hazel Westbury.
Hazel, lovely to meet you this evening. Thank you for coming. I do know in the evaluation report that they have looked at international models, but Ken in his new report is also going broadly, and what we can do is write to him just to add your suggestions to his work. And it's one of the reasons why we're really keen to see this report. So we'll do that, Hazel. Thank you very much. Were there any other questions? Come on up.
Hi, Susanna Louie from East Melbourne. I wanted to also contribute to what we have just discussed. I live on the border of Melbourne and North Richmond, so I pretty much see what's going on. And I just... now that we potentially are going to have another safe injecting room. And I just, for the record, want to say that I actually do believe in evidence-based research and I believe in safe injecting rooms. What I don't believe in is the Andrews government's safe injecting room. I don't believe it does enough. Its catch and release program means that we don't actually help people beyond saving their lives each day. And that's probably not good enough, and it's not actually changing their lives. What it's doing is letting them go back and be addicted again. I helped in the food outreach in North Richmond, and I spoke to a mother who said that she had to keep close ties with her teenage son because of the huge access to drugs that they have in their area. She says they have the dealers give them 3 free hits so that they can get them addicted. The vulnerable children and teenagers have seen drugs normalized in their lives. North Richmond is breeding the next generation of drug addicts because we are not doing a good enough job with that safe injecting room. And I need you guys to, when you open yours, to think about those vulnerable people, because we're not thinking about how it's affecting these other people. We have a very narrow focus on what success looks like, and it's actually not good enough. And I believe that it's actually going to be killing people in the future because it's normalized it so much. And it absolutely has devastated the area. I've been here for 20 years. I used to be able to take my children to Victoria Street, and I can't do that anymore. There's no way that I can take them there. I'm offered drugs. I see blood on the streets. That didn't happen. That report, when it says that nothing has changed, is absolutely lying. I cannot tell you how disappointed I am when I hear things like that spoken, because people out there tell me, who live in the area, that my life is the same, and it's not. Mm. Thank you.
Suzanne, thank you. And the comments tonight across councillors and from members of the public really go to how complex this issue is, and I really recommend that for members of the public that they're looking at the full report. They also look at the debate and the motion we had on the 25th of May and also the motion that was passed this evening, which suggests changes, but also looking at the breadth of impacts, and ultimately those broader contributions to a very, very sensitive issue. But your comments tonight are appreciated. Thank you. Thank you. I know I've broken the rules because strictly we don't take questions on items that were on the agenda. They need to be other items, but thank you for staying right to the end of this meeting, and your comments are noted. If there are no other questions, then I'm going to call the meeting closed, and it's 8:58 p.m. Thanks everyone for participating.